happening in the background. Yeah.
Eventually, that's what it'll be. But right now, it's coffee. This episode of the Joe Rogan Experience podcast... I fucking said it. I said my own name. I hate doing that. The podcast. It's very douchey when someone says their own name. Unless you really have to. Like, someone asks you what your name is. And you go, my name's Joe Rogan. Then it's okay. But if you say it, especially if someone's tuning into a podcast that has your name on it... I'm just trying to not be as douchey as possible, folks. It's hard. It's very hard. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Stamps.com is a way, if you have a small business, or even if you do things from your office, it's a way to avoid all the lines at the post office and send shit directly from your office, your home, wherever you are, and printing official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, right from your computer or printer. It's very easy to do. You weigh it, you hand it to the mailman, and with our special offer, using the code word JRE, you get a free digital scale and up to $55 of free postage. It's a glorious deal, ladies and gentlemen. It's super easy to do. It cuts out all the fucking wasted time that you get if you go to the post office. And you could do all this stuff, print everything up, drunk and naked. A bonus. $110 bonus offer, no risk trial. Use the code word JRE. And get up to $55 again of free postage. So don't wait. Go to stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in JRE. That's stamps.com and type in JRE. We're also brought to you by 1-800-Flowers. It's Mother's Day, freaks. It's right around the corner. Was it this Sunday?
Yes.
It's always this Sunday, right? It's always on Sunday? Is Mother's Day always on Sunday?
Yes.
Should be. It would suck if your mom had Mother's Day and it was on a Tuesday. That would be some bullshit. Mothers deserve credit. They deserve respect. Without them, you would not be alive, ladies and gentlemen. Your mother gave birth to you. Deal with that and go to 1-800-Flowers.com. Scrape up some shekels. What's a shekel worth? Tim Kennedy, you're a worldly man. What's a shekel worth?
I have no idea.
This is a shekel to dollars ratio. I don't know what, it's. I just know it has something to do with Jews. You got to be careful when you use shekel. Jews are very touchy. Anyway, available only Thursday, May 8th through Thursday, May 8th, which is tomorrow. 1-800-Flowers.com has a special Mother's Day offer for my listeners. They're not my listeners, but you know what I'm talking about. 24 beautiful multicolored roses for just $29.99. That's a full bouquet of 24 stunning roses. And you can't beat this offer. Regularly, it's $49.99. Now, only $29.99. You save $20, but you got to order it soon because it expires on Thursday, May 8th. So hurry, order today and available while supplies last. To get this bouquet delivered in time for Mother's Day, you must go to 1-800-Flowers.com from your desktop or mobile device. Click on the radio microphone in the upper right-hand corner and enter in JRE. That's 1-800-Flowers.com and enter in JRE. Or call 1-800-Flowers.com and mention JRE. I'm going to get them to my mom, but I got to wait because my mom's in Mexico. My mom is moving to Mexico. Crazy bitch. She's crazy. And I mean bitch with all due respect. I call myself a bitch. I call everybody a bitch. I don't really mean like a female dog or... a bad person. I mean, if you're really thinking about moving to Mexico, you're fucking crazy. Anyway, Mother's Day. Go, 1-800-Flowers.com. Use the code word JRE and save yourself some money and hook your mom up. She'll be happy if you did. We're also brought to you by Onnit.com. That's O-N-N-I-T, official sponsor of Tim Kennedy. We got to figure out a way to sponsor fighters actually in the UFC. The UFC has a muscle farm monopoly right now.
Yeah.
We have to break that.
I would care. I wouldn't care if it was actually good products, but Muscle Farm is not.
It's not?
No, I don't think so.
I've never used it. Yes. What is it? It's like protein powders and stuff?
It's like plastic that
fills your stomach up.
Yeah.
What is it? I don't know. What is Muscle Farm?
They make all the typical, you know, the pre-workouts, post-workouts, proteins, toilet stuff, you know, like jacks your heart rate up to 180 before your workout, and then afterwards when... Yeah, and it supposedly tastes good. It's just full of sugar. I've never had a good experience with a single Muscle Farm product. Obviously, I like Onnit.
Whoa, Tim Kennedy just laid down the law. How rude. I have nothing bad to say about Muscle Farm. I have no relationship with them. I have no experience with them. But I do have a deep, long, and storied experience with Onnit. Our protein powder is 100% natural and also 100% sugar-free. The only sugar is 1 gram of sugar, which is naturally occurring per serving that comes from the hemp. I have to answer this. I have to say this every episode, but just because I get asked all the time. If you eat hemp, you will not test positive for marijuana. Hemp does not have any THC in it. But again, if you eat poppy seed bagels, you will test positive for heroin. It sounds crazy, but it's totally true. Hemp Force, we use the finest available protein powder that we can buy, which we have to buy from Canada because the laws are fucking goofy in America and we're not allowed to grow hemp. We can buy it, but we can't support American farmers, which drives me fucking crazy. Hopefully, the laws have been changed, and hopefully soon we will be able to support farmers and buy our own. Well, we're supporting Canadian farmers, but we'll hopefully be able to support American farmers and maybe even get our own hemp farm. Right now, though, it's a little too sketch, and I don't want to go to jail. So we buy it, and then we sell it. We sell the best shit that we can find, whether it's strength and conditioning equipment. We sell just the finest kettlebells and steel maces and clubs and weight vests. If we find something and it's good, we find something that's beneficial, whether it's a supplement or a food, we sell it. And we try to get it at the most reasonable rates possible, and we find the best quality stuff, whatever it is, whether it's the best quality protein powders, whether it's the best quality walnut, almond, cashew butter, anything we sell, raw organic coconut oil, we just try to sell the best shit available. And we try to sell it to you as cheaply as possible. If you use the code name Rogan, you will save 10% off any and all supplements. Tim Kennedy is here. Let's cue the music. Why fuck around? Ta, ta, ta.
Joe Rogan Podcast, check it out.
The Joe Rogan Experience.
Train by day, Joe Rogan Podcast by night, all day.
Tim Kennedy, ladies and gentlemen. I've been wanting to talk to you for a while, dude. You're an interesting cat. You've been around the world. You're saying that you're laughing like you're not?
No, I'm not laughing that I'm not interesting. But I had wanted to talk to you in the octagon for a really long time. So we
took a while.
Did take a long time.
It took a while.
12 years as a pro to finally get a little Joe interview.
Yeah, but the interview was you couldn't ask for a better environment to do that first interview.
No, that was fun.
You know, do it when the UFC fight for the troops, mm-hmm. You know, to do it and to do it after that spectacular knockout and just that was intense, man. And it wasn't just intense because you won. What was really intense for me is, and I've always experienced this in these fights for the troops. First of all, it's great to be able to go to them and put on these fights and have them in these hangars and in these tight environments. And just the appreciation and the respect that everybody has for the fighters is really intense. But you, first of all, you being a veteran and you being unabashed in your love for soldiers and your respect for your fellow military members, when you got on top of that cage and after, you know, they were cheering and you were yelling out to all those people that you loved them. I mean, this is all off camera, man. We had cut to commercial and you're on top of the cage and you're just yelling at all those people, letting them know that you love them. That's some intense, intense shit.
Yeah. Overwhelming emotional near shutdown.
Yeah.
You know, I'm walking out to the cage. I see this dude. He flies for the 160th, which is like the Special Forces wing of aviation. The last time I saw that dude was I was handing him my shot buddy. You know, I'm like, it's a big thing in Special Forces community. We're real tight. You know, like I'm handing him my brother that has bullet holes in him. And I'm like, I don't want to let him go. And he's like, hey, I got this. This is what I do. You go do what you're supposed to do and get back to work. That was the last time I saw this dude, was handing him my buddy on a medevac. Then I'm walking out to the cage and I was like, holy shit, there is that dude from the 160th that I handed my shot buddy to. Totally overwhelming. Then I have to go in there and fight. And then, nice. 5th Special Forces Group is co-located there. So I saw a bunch of dudes from, you know, like the Green Beret Regiment. Yeah, it was entirely too much emotion. I just wanted to like curl up and cry.
Yeah, it's a completely different kind of. There's you on top of the cage up there in that photo. That's just an intense, intense picture. That picture should be framed and on your wall somewhere because that is one of the greatest pictures I've ever seen.
If you could cut me out and just have the dudes.
No. Yeah. You need to be in there for reference. Yeah, I mean, but that's your attitude. What you just said, cut me out and leave the dudes. That really is your attitude. You really don't want the you were saying while you were up there that my job is in here is easy. What you guys do, you guys are my heroes.
Yep.
You know,
you have a good memory.
Yeah, I remember everything.
That's disturbing. Scary. Don't get in a fight with Joe Rogan verbally. This does not go well for you.
I remember things. I remember important things, and that was a deep moment. You know, there was I wrote a thing a long time ago about one of the fights for the troops about the national anthem, and I recorded it. I filmed it on my phone when someone was singing the national anthem, and you turn around and you know I was filming the crowd while it was all going on, and the feeling in the air, the electricity in the air of hearing the national anthem while you're around active duty soldiers who are in a war currently, have had friends, had loved ones die, have experienced firefights, have been there, have come back, and now they're here in time off, getting to enjoy a fight, and everyone's standing up, and there's electricity in the air, man. Your fucking hairs are standing up on your back. It's just
crazy.
It's intense. It's intense. Yep. It's a totally different experience.
Yep. It's there. Yeah, I don't know. I don't understand the whole realm outside of like what you can physically see, but there's no way to describe, you know, like moments like that where you're surrounded by these heroes, that these selfless freaking superstars of humanity, and you know, they bleed in every sense of the word for their country. And then the national anthem come on, or the flag goes up, and you see them all. And there's this energy there that just can't be described. It can only be experienced. It's surreal.
You know, that's the really intense aspect of it, is that there's a lot of resistance and blowback towards war and towards the military industrial complex and towards
both of which are horrible.
Yeah, but what's important is, Everybody wants everything to be black and white, and there's no black and white in this world. There's this gigantic spectrum of shades, and there's positive and there's negative, there's good and there's bad. But there are real heroes in the world. Pat Tillman is a perfect example of a guy who is a real hero, in my opinion. A guy who saw what was going on and said, you know what, fuck this NFL career. I don't need millions of dollars. What I need to do is do what's right, and I need to fight for my country. He goes over there, and then when he gets there, he experiences chaos and nonsense, and he's super vocal about it, and completely, as is his brother. And that's, to me, a perfect example of that there is no black and white. There's real heroes. There's people that have heroic intent, and there's people that have heroic ideals, and they really do love and respect the idea of freedom. But they get thrust into a situation where everything is completely out of control and chaotic. And a guy like Pat Tillman was very vocal about it.
Yeah. And well-spoken.
Very well-spoken, yeah. As is his brother. You know, it's a very intense thing. And when when people are anti-war, and, you know, it's fashionable to be anti-war. You know, it's a thing that a lot of people put on like an outfit. They just sort of jump into the sentiment that we shouldn't have a military and we shouldn't have war. The real problem is human beings are still animals in a lot of respects, a lot of senses. And probably nobody knows that more than a guy like you who's been there.
War is horrible. I hate war. I am anti-war. I've been anti-war my whole entire life with, you know, uncles that fought in World War II. Or in Vietnam, you know, grandparents that fought in World War II. But with that position of being anti-war, I don't think you should be able to be anti-war unless you understand at a fundamental level how awful and horrible war is. Not that doesn't mean that you have to go and serve, but it's necessary. You know, it's I wouldn't wish, you know, what I've seen in my life on my worst enemy. You know, there's no way I'd want the people I hate to have to see, you know, what a little girl looks like once she's been had acid thrown on her because she tried to go to school. I want that on my worst enemy. But there's people that do those things. You know, there's people that go and kidnap 300 girls in school, you know, this week because they were going to school. You know, those people they have to answer to somebody. And the only people they would answer to are guys like me or guys that are better than me that are still doing it. And it's a necessary evil. You know, you fight fire with fire. You fight evil with just a more violent, better version of evil, which is
And that's a crazy way to look at the world, but in a lot of respects, there's no other options. In some situations, there are no other options unless you let evil overwhelm an area or evil overwhelm a group of innocent people. There's almost no options. And to deny the existence of evil is completely fucking ridiculous.
Yeah.
Especially if you just look at human history. Look at human history from recorded times. From the beginning when people started writing things down, people always did awful shit if they could get away with it.
Yeah. Well, to get away with it, for evil to prevail, all it takes is for good men to do nothing, right? So
yes, great quote. Yeah.
You just have to do something, even if it's horrible.
How long were you over there for?
I was 8 years active duty, Special Forces, and now it's been 3 years as a National Guardsman in Special Forces.
So. And how old are you now?
34.
So, wow. So you were really young. So you're essentially like, you know, college age.
Yeah. As soon as I was in grad school when I enlisted.
And how old were you then?
I was 22.
Wow. So you saw what was going on and you just decided that this was calling you.
It was a balance. It was like the perfect storm for me to go in. I was kind of, this was before, we'll call it pro. I was a pro MMA fighter and I had 5 fights. I was 4-1. You know, I just won this ECC 50 big 8-man tournament. You know, Jason Miller, Dennis Kang, myself were all in it and I was the one that won it. So like I had good promise. I was a douchebag. I was a little idiot. You know, in San Luis Obispo, with the mecca of fighting at the time, worrying about what jeans I was going to wear to the next party, you know, like, with my next winnings from this fight, I'm going to go buy these something stupid.
Did you have jeans that were like already ripped?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like, can I pay way too much for really crappy jeans that looks cool? Anyways, so making a lot of poor decisions and, you know, 9/11 happened and it was just one of those instances that's godsend, divine intervention maybe, where you get this existential perspective of how much of an idiot you are. And that's what I had. I was like, God, I am really one of the worst people on the planet. Not being a productive contributing member to society in any way, just being a succubus of life. So I walked down after 9/11 to the recruiter's office and I wish I could just knock on the door, but that wasn't the issue. The issue was that there was like 1,000 other dudes in line ahead of me that all wanted to do the same thing. And just to give you a testament about how amazing the backbone of our country still is.
What was that feeling like when you showed up and you see 1,000 other people that are like
wrapping around the supermarket
that have the same mentality?
Humbling, you know, where you're like, again, I'm still a little fucktard, you know? I was like thinking, I'm going to go enlist, you know? And I get down there, I was like, well, man, I should have been here like 5 hours ago, you know? And, instance after instance, yeah. It was cool. It was amazing. It was humbling is what it was to see all these dudes ahead of you that their instant reaction. You know, it wasn't a little retrospective perspective of like what you're doing in your life. It was like, fuck this. Those dudes just flew planes into our buildings. I'm going, you know, that's what they were, where I was a little bit late. So I think just the response is humbling.
Yeah, it's very tricky because the people that flew the planes are already dead, right? Yeah. So it's, but the idea that there's a faction of the world that's planning things along these lines and it's willing to go to such extreme lengths. When you see shit like that happen in the world and you see it from a perspective of an outsider versus seeing it from a perspective of someone who's actually there and in the military, what is the difference? Like, what is the feeling like? Like, once you became active duty, once you're there, what is the difference in your perspective?
You know, at 9/11, I think everybody remembers exactly where they were. You know, I'm no different. I remember the exact place that I was and exactly what I was doing. You know, and I remember my response being anger. You know, like, I wanted to lash out in revenge. I don't have that that's not in me anymore. You know, I never respond that way anymore. When I see things happen, I almost have like this cold, calculated response. You know, like, I hear about something happening and I don't want to like go over with a baseball bat and smash a bunch of dudes' heads in like I did, you know, 12 years ago. Now it's like when Bin Laden was killed. You know, I spent some prime years of my life in mountains of Afghanistan, Pakistan, looking for that idiot. And then Navy SEALs go in and get him, you know, and I was like, dang it, I missed it. You know, I was kind of sad. I wasn't mad. I wasn't angry. I didn't want to be there. I didn't want to shoot him myself. But I was like, oh, man.
You didn't want to shoot him yourself?
I would love to have shot him myself. But I wasn't mad that I didn't get to, which was like my response, you know, 11, 12 years ago. Just calculated, like,
That whole event was one of the biggest, like, what do you think really happened conspiracies online, when they didn't show the body and they threw it in the ocean and the whole idea that he was going to be a martyr. Like, that was so perplexing to me. The whole thing was so completely perplexing to me. Like, why wouldn't you just show his body? Like, can't we take a look? The whole world wants to see the bad guy.
Yeah. When you just historically through the course of this war, when we've done it on numerous instances, whether it's Saddam hanging or Zarqawi and his blown up body, like some I was involved with, some I wasn't. It's been very clear the response by the fanatic side when they see the body. You know, maybe that person becomes a martyr. You know, and then he's like idolized for years, or maybe it just incites an immediate riot. So yeah, it sucks. We want to have that justice feeling of like the conclusion, the finality of like, there's Bin Laden, he's dead. Look at that pointy beard of his. That's definitely him. All right, we can sleep at night. You know, the boogeyman Bin Laden's not under the bed. But had they done that, the repercussions would have been so much more severe with riots and possibly, you know, a long-standing martyrdom. So I don't know.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Shades of gray, like you said, it sucks.
Yeah, I'm selfish.
Yeah.
I want to see the dead body.
Yeah.
And plus, I don't totally believe everything they say. So, you know, when you talk to high-ranking military guys that say, that guy's been dead forever. He's been dead a long time ago. That was another part of the conspiracy. Guys that were, you know, in the know was saying, I think that guy was dead already.
There's no way that he's still alive, because we've probably killed him like 10 times now. You know? So whether this was the final version of him or the 10th, it's irrelevant. All versions of Bin Laden are dead.
Yeah, he's not Jason. No. He's not going to pop up out of the ocean.
The 11th time.
Yeah, swim to shore. Uh-uh. Tricked you, bitch. Yeah, I'm going to start from scratch. The idea is terrifying to us. Like, fanatical religious fundamentalists that are willing to die is terrifying for a good reason. It's one of the worst aspects of human beings, is that we can talk people into believing in some completely ridiculous shit and talk them into believing it so much so that they're willing to kill themselves.
Yeah.
And we all, the other problem with human beings is that once a guy gets that far, once a human, man, woman, whatever, is that far gone, how do you bring him back?
You don't.
I have a friend who has adopted a child. And the kid was, I think she was probably 3 when they adopted her. And she's about 6 now. And the poor kid's a mess. You know, and they're really worried. They don't know what to do. She experienced a lot of abuse before they ever got to her. And now she's 6 years old. And they're just trying to wrangle her and educate her and give her love and give her. But they're like, God damn, if we just got there sooner. Yeah. That's their idea. You're talking about 3 years old. You know, get some guy who's fucking 30 and he's a la Wakba all day, you know, bowing and ready to be a martyr. And it's impossible to change the course of that sort of ideology.
Yeah. I have no idea how. If you're smart.
Ecstasy, mushrooms, isolation, reprogramming, you know, some of the.
And my solution was way easier.
Yeah.
But I had infinitely more repercussions.
Yeah. Well, you know what? We're all going to live. We're all going to die. And you got to pull weeds out of a garden sometimes. Yeah. That's just the reality of the situation.
Yep.
The idea of equating a human being like a weed is pretty gross, but it's just a bad analogy.
We're not all flowers.
Yeah.
I don't think you're a flower.
No, I don't think I'm a flower. I'm a vegetable. Some sort of a...
I'm an artichoke. I have layers.
Artichokes are great. I love artichokes. I'm like a pineapple. I'm rough on the outside, but inside I'm delicious.
But the core is really hard as well, so...
Yes. Mm, yeah.
There's elements to you.
Deep inside, I'm very fibrous. Once you get...
It's a good metaphor. I like it.
So you were over there, and you continued your mixed martial arts training while you were over there as well?
Yeah, Special Forces as a whole, like, there's the expectation that all of us are just good fighters. Like, we're just born badasses. Obviously, this is not the case, right? Nobody is. So we train. You know, we shoot all day long, and morning and night we fight. You know, usually PT is some form of jiu-jitsu, boxing, wrestling, kickboxing, hand-to-hand combat, small arms. And then evening is more recreational, you know, after you get back from the range. So you get up, you work out, then you go to the range and shoot for, you know, 3-4 hours, go back, clean the guns, and then your evening is usually on the mat. That's Monday through Thursday. Friday is you're trying to fix whatever you broke during the week. That's the week.
So do you guys, when they set up training for you, whether it's physical martial arts training or fitness training, is there instructors who set a program for you? Like, how does it work?
So sometimes you bring in experts. You know, Hoist Gracie came, you know, and trained us countless times. You know, Greg Jackson comes out still. You know, guys like Greg Thompson, you know, he's a Hoist black belt. He's there permanently. So there's permanent fixtures at the Special Forces installations that train guys on a daily basis, and they have relationships to bring in experts. Obviously, you know, what you do in a house when you blow a door in, when you're going inside on a kill capture mission, is different than you're going to do in the cage. So it has to be guys that can adapt whatever they're teaching or know what their limitations are. You know, Greg Jackson doesn't go in there and try to teach knife fighting. You know, he knows what his left and right limits are, but he's one of the best. So he comes in and gives the best instruction that he can to try to provide tools for guys to be better at what they do.
You train a lot down there in Albuquerque?
I do, yeah.
He's a fascinating guy.
He is a cool cat.
He's a one of a kind, very unique dude. Like, really humble, Like, there's a lot of people that pretend to be humble, but if you pick away at him, and you find some bullshit, just putting on a
No, he's humble to
mask.
A fault.
To a fault?
Yeah.
How so?
He and Winklejohn both, I say humble to a fault, where they have they have all these things to give. They're the best that there has ever been on coaching staff. They've trained more champions. They have the best stable of fighters on the planet, arguably. And they're still training guys, you know, and it's not by design. This is just out of, like, almost necessity. This scary staff. No, it's not even scary. I don't know. Out of a barn, warehouse, you know, like industrial, commercial, ghetto building, you know, like where I can walk out the door and score some meth as fast as I can come inside and get around with John Jones. You know, those are my options. Front door parking lot, get some meth, come in.
It's that bad a neighborhood?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Really?
Yeah.
All you ever see is the outside, you know?
Yeah, no.
Jackson Winklejohn, like, oh,
driving
yeah.
down Central, it's like you can count anywhere from 4 to 8 transvestites any given morning.
Nice. And then, variety.
No, yeah. There's a famous one named Grace. She's this beautiful black girl that wears this huge wig, and she's like 4 or 5 inches taller than I am and probably 50 pounds bigger than I am.
Whoa.
Yeah. And, but it's, you know,
bring her in.
I know. She's amazing. She's scary.
Bring her in.
And every corner is like, oh, there's that drug dealer. There's this drug dealer. And then you're like, wait, is that the guy from Breaking Bad? No. Maybe it is. Is he really selling meth? And then the irony is there. No, that is not the guy from Breaking Bad, but he's really selling meth and he's dressed like the guy from Breaking Bad.
It's cool. Wow.
Yeah, that is what it's like there.
Albuquerque is a weird spot.
It is. It's yeah. kooky.
Why do they stay? It's just because the gym's there and
yeah.
good stable of tough guys there?
I mean, I would love it if Mike Winklejohn and Greg Jackson, you know, let's say we're in Austin, Texas,
yes.
you know,
yes.
or L.A. or, you know, San Luis Obispo, but they're in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So that's where I go. If they're in Idaho, that's where I would go, but that's where they are. So
you train in Austin during your time in between fights.
Yes.
How do you like plan out like how many weeks do you give yourself where you go to Albuquerque?
I get 6 weeks, 6 good weeks in Albuquerque. So, you know, hopefully you'll get 10 week heads up to your fight. So then I have 4 weeks to start doing pre-fight camp develop, you know, like strength, speed, explosion type physical stuff, working on specific techniques, and then move to Albuquerque for the 6 weeks for the kind of final fight camp.
You train at a great spot in Austin, too. I was down there really recently, and I met the owner of that facility. What's that guy's
Donald
name?
Parks and Paulio Brandao.
Yeah. Great facility.
Amazing.
Yeah. Really nice guys, too.
Yep.
And so you do just all your the most in-between fight preparation there.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Good group of fighters out of there as well.
Yep. Eastside Austin Elite. Justin Lake was my strength and conditioning coach. He's like my brother on a whole bunch of different levels. He married my sister or my my wife's sister. We used to go to college together. We used to hang out with the same girls together. And then we enlisted together. He went to Special Forces. We went to 7th Group together. We went to Afghanistan together. And then he married my sister-in-law.
He might be stalking you.
Yeah, no. So. I hope not, because he's like 200 pounds, the snatches, 250 pounds, deadlifts, 500 pounds. It would be a bad thing if he was stalking me.
Is he fighting? Is he do MMA?
No.
Just trains?
Just trains. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of those dudes that are scary that just train.
Yeah.
And like, hmm.
Yeah. Please don't ever get mad at me and tear my limbs off and beat me to death.
How did you get hooked up with Jackson and Winklejohn?
When I lost the Strikeforce title to Jacare, it was a really close fight.
Very close fight. I thought you won.
I thought I did too, but it was close. And there were just like small adjustments I needed to make, and adjustments that I wasn't making on my own. I needed somebody that was smarter than me to tell me what those were and how to prepare for them. You know, so since then I'm 7-1 since I went there.
Yeah, Jackson's an interesting guy, in that he didn't have any professional MMA fights.
Mm-mm.
But he's a virtuoso. I mean, he really is. Like, I've had long conversations with him about strategy and weird shit, about music, about how, you know, he listens to symphonies and compares the rhythm of symphonies to the changing rhythm of a fight.
Yep. He looks at everything as strategy, whether it's like he's playing Lemmings, like the old school Lemmings, you know.
I don't even know what that is.
Oh, it's a video game where you like move Lemmings to certain portions of the map to try to achieve some stupid engineering goal. It's a very like archaic, like 16-bit game from like almost Commodore 64 type things, where like he still plays stat. Not often, but he's like, you know, everything has strategy, whether it's chess or backgammon, you know, or if he's like playing Monopoly with the family, you know, it's like everything's about strategy. You know,
he had a conversation with my friend Ari. My friend Ari Shafir has a podcast called Skeptic Tank, and Ari's a really smart dude. And him and Greg Jackson, Greg was his guest, and Greg was like picking his brain about the comparisons. Like, he's trying to figure out how one crafts a piece of comedy and like tries to attack an audience with it. Like how you get an idea past the boundaries of someone's consciousness.
Can that be adaptive?
Yeah.
You know, like when you're talking to this audience, you already have kind of the template of what you're trying to get to them, but then their responsiveness, you know, like can it change? Like I envision that is exactly something that Greg would do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to listen to his mind, because I don't know anybody like him. It's a very unique sort of a mindset.
Yeah.
And then Winklejohn, who's a great striking coach, was a great kickboxer himself. Mm-hmm. You know, he's an interesting guy too.
Yeah. He's like the yin to the yang with Greg. You know, he's a linear thinker. You know, he knows what, like, where Greg wants you to paint the best version of yourself. Winklejohn doesn't have that kind of responsive approach to you. He knows what you need to do to be better, you know, and he says, this is what you should do to be better, and this is what we're going to drill it relentlessly until you are. You know, Greg's like, all right, you know, like, I want to see you develop this. Let me give you some tools so you can implement this in your fighting style, and it's going to be adaptive to every single different athlete that he has. Where Winklejohn's like, no, this is what you need to do, and this is how we're going to do it. And you're like, yes, sir. Please don't hurt me. You know, what eye do I look at?
What eye do I look at? For folks who don't know, he lost an eye in training. They threw a kick, and the toenail missed the pad and caught his eyeball, which is the first I've ever heard of that happening, ever. I've heard of guys getting scratched badly in training from sparring, but never from holding pads.
No, he wears safety glasses every time he holds now. You know,
he has to. He has one eye. Can he see anything out of that other eye?
No, definitely not.
Wow.
No, the eye like poured out of his face.
Fuck.
I was like, that was my eye.
Fuck.
Safety
glasses. Trim your toenails, bitches.
Seriously. Dude, yeah. I get on the mat, fingernails and toenails and hygiene, like,
It's gross.
No, I'm not rolling with you. Go clean yourself and trim that stuff.
Yeah, I got one of the nastiest infections once from a guy peeling my hooks off, and he had these giant fingernails. Yeah. And I brought it out to the class. I'm like, come here, folks. Look at this.
Yeah.
You can't have this.
That's okay? Got to go.
This is, you're going to fuck everybody. It's not going to make you a better fighter. Yeah. You can't have this. This
I have toenail clippers in my jiu-jitsu bag.
Yes, it's like me too. Yeah.
Gi, belt, headgear, mouthpiece, toenail clippers.
And file them bitches too.
Yeah.
Cut them, and then there's rough edges. File those bitches down. Yeah, when you see guys like about to go into the cage, and Herb Dean would look at their nails, and then they're like, they bite. I'm like, no,
this is get scratched.
This is not the time for that. You don't bite them down now. You should have done that already.
Yeah. Then you come home, and your wife's like, why do you have scratches all over you? You're like, I fight for a living. Why do you think I have scratches on me? You know, golly.
Yeah, that's hilarious. Yeah. Why are they on your back? Because someone who's fucking scratching my back.
I know.
All right?
I didn't want them to.
The moan scratches. Oh, Tim. Oh, more. Yeah, not good. Is there a solution for fucking eye pokes?
We change the gloves.
What should be done?
Heaven forbid we ever say that anything was done better in Pride.
Yeah.
Their gloves are better.
They're better, right?
They're better.
They're curved more?
They're curved. They got, like, how many guys right now do you see with broken hands?
A lot.
It's like tons of them. So we have this padding, like, on the 2/3 of our hands, right? Well, that's not where we break our hands. We break our hands in the metacarpals at the back of the wrist or just above the wrist, the bottom of your hand. Pride gloves had padding there, which provided support. So it's a lot harder to break your hands. They're also, the padding was curved. So it was actually had to straighten your, I'm a grappler, obviously, you know, like I like to grapple. So as a grappler, I could complain that like, I want to have the total use of my extremities, you know.
Right. No gloves would be better for most grapplers.
Yeah, absolutely.
You could slide things in better.
With that said, I don't want to get poked in the eye.
Yeah.
So the Pride gloves. That's how we make them better.
Yeah, why, we own Pride. The UFC owns Pride.
Just take their gloves and just take the word Pride off of it and then put those three letters on there. Bam!
Yeah, they brought over some new glove and they're like, here's the new glove. And I put it on and I was like, why? What the fuck is the difference? Yeah. It's just slightly curved. Like, these bitches should be like really curved. Mm-hmm. Like, whereas if you want to do that, it's an effort. And when you relax, it goes right back to that.
But the effort is for 15 to 25 minutes.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure my hand is strong enough to go like that when I need it to.
Yeah.
For 15 to 25 minutes.
Well, I mean, as long as you can do it in certain situations, like, you know, you're trying to apply a choke or something, but it's very disheartening to me, all the people that are having detached retinas and Alan Belcher's eyes fucked up. Bisping, Bisping's eyes all fucked up.
I can't look at him in the eye when we're fine. I was just like,
well, he's got oil in his eye.
They inject oil in his eye, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
and I don't know what he can see out of it or what it looks like. I mean, I guess it's diminished in some respect.
Yeah, it has to be.
Yeah, it's so fucking weird. And he's had a couple eye surgeries, right? Yeah. Bisping's had more than one eye surgery. Yep. It's fucking crazy, man.
I like my eyes. I don't want them.
Yeah.
I need them.
Is it possible to do something where the fingers aren't exposed?
Like, you chop them off.
No. Okay. I'm talking about like a covering. Like, what I was thinking of is like a lambskin sort of a covering, something that's not thick, but like maybe like a band around the tips where you don't really do this ever anyway. You know? Do you?
Yeah.
When do you do that?
Body lock, takedown stuff.
You grab like this?
No.
No.
No, but
like, you do this.
You still have this.
Well, wouldn't you
this.
Still have that?
I don't know.
I mean, do you mostly do this?
Let's
right?
design it.
Okay. Well, I'm
Let's
saying
try.
When I'm the, for folks who are listening, there's a thing called the Gable grip, and the way a Gable grip works is, picture your hand if you're going to karate chop someone, and your thumb was pressed tight against the side of your hand. Then have your hands like in a cross position where one sideways and one is sitting straight up, and then crush down with your hands with your fingertips. That would be what a Gable grip is like, and that is the majority of wrestling, of grabbing when you cinch around the waist. That's most of the way you grab. The other way would be an S grip, which is you would, you know, make like an like a
69
hook with
your fingers.
Yeah, 69. That's it. Yin and yang. If you're more uncouth or couth, and you grab like that, but you never, very rarely do you do this. Very rarely do you let your fingers intersect with each other. So they don't have to be free like that. And when they're free, that's when fingers go in eyeballs.
Yep.
You know? I thought maybe there could be some sort of a flexible, rounded covering which would eliminate
Seems like
pokes.
They've had to have tried it, you know?
I don't think they have.
Well, let's give it a whirl.
it's amazing to me how things just stay stagnant when they're retarded. Like when they don't make any sense. Like
these gloves suck.
The 12 to 6 elbow.
God, I love those. Why can't we do those?
They should be in.
Knees to the head on the ground.
Yeah. Well, you telling me you can kick someone in the head with your shin, but you can't drop an elbow down your head? Someone has never been kicked in the head with a shin.
No, obviously.
That's the only reason why you would make that
rule.
Can we
like thank John McCain for this one? Wasn't it that like that era?
It
like,
was that era. Yeah. According to John McCarthy, who was there when it was all going on. John McCarthy, famous referee, the gold standard.
Love that guy.
Great guy. Big John told me that they were having this meeting with the athletic commission, and they had seen like karate brick breaking demonstrations on ESPN at like 2 o'clock in the morning, like, and the boards shatter and everything. Well, they said you can't do that move because that move could kill someone.
Yeah, if you can break bricks, you can obviously break somebody's neck.
Exactly.
And just blow their scalp.
So that is the real reason why the 12 to 6 elbow is illegal. But arguably, this elbow is stronger.
Definitely.
It's got more torque to it. It's a more natural movement of the body. This is an awkward movement in comparison.
Yeah, but I mean, do you remember Cobra Kai?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, Daniel's son watched those guys breaking boards.
Yeah, it's tough to argue with that kind of logic. No, but that is the logic that literally is a complete pure ignorance. If you asked like mixed martial arts competitors, trainers, fighters, people in the know, and ask them what should be illegal, the 12 to 6 elbow is not going to be on that list.
Nowhere near.
It's a fine technique. Yeah. It's a good technique. It's excellent. As are knees on the ground. Mm-hmm. I think knees on the ground, and it could be, you know, if someone wanted to have some sort of a compromise, maybe it would be knees on the ground when you're not pressed up against the cage. That could be a possibility. You know, the idea being that the knees to the head on the ground would be problematic against the cage because a guy couldn't move. And that was one of the good things about Pride was the ropes.
Yeah.
If soccer kicks and all those things, you can kind of scoot your head under the ropes to get away from things. You're not contained by your environment to the point where you would suffer a damaging blow that you could have avoided by your own power.
Yeah. I mean, outside of like the north-south, you know, 69 mm-hmm. position for knees to the head on the ground, that's the only position I could think, you know, like obviously the limitation is you still can't strike to the top of the head or the back of the head with a knee.
Right.
And that under that premise, then it doesn't really matter you're kneeing somebody from because you can't hurt them any worse than you could in any other way with any other strike from any other position.
Right.
So.
Yeah, and also, I don't like this thing the guys are doing where they drop one hand down to avoid being kneed in the head and they pick it up
fight.
And they drop it down.
Like, oh, let's gameplay this.
Yeah,
the game. I'm down. I'm down. Don't knee me.
Yeah.
I'm up.
Well, it's very, very weird. It's a weird gray area that I think needs to be sat down. And then, of course, there's the scoring system, which is adopted from boxing, this 10-point must scoring system, which is just terrible. And the implementation of it is even more terrible because very few 10-8 rounds get scored.
Yeah.
I mean,
rarely.
There's 10-9 rounds that are squeakers. Right? Like maybe one of your rounds with Jacare might have been a 10-9 round. And then there's 10-9 rounds where a guy just gets fucking mollywopped.
Dropped 2-3 times.
And it's still a 10-9 round. Like, how is that possible? It's a terrible system. Yeah. And I don't know if you ever saw Doc Hamilton's scoring system.
Yeah.
He had a half-point scoring system, which is much better.
Way better.
Way better.
I would want Doc Hamilton's and to know what the scores are every round.
I agree, 100%. I agree. Every other fucking game, whether it's football, basketball, everything else. Yeah. I think it should be that way in boxing, too. So it would discourage shitty judges from continuing their shittiness.
Yep. And shitty fighters from continuing their shittiness.
Yes.
You know?
The only real worry would be that a guy would be so far ahead that he would run in the last round.
He's up 4 rounds.
Yeah.
John Jones moving to the 5th round against Glover.
Right, right,
you know,
right.
He's like, all right, I have this.
But a guy like John wouldn't do that anyway.
No, neither would I, you know?
Yeah, yeah. The great fighters would still fight the same. And not only that, the other guy is going to get more desperate, so it'll make it even more exciting because he's going to have to.
Yeah.
And if he doesn't, like, well, are you not trying to win? Like, you know you're not going to win a decision. So either you just fucking throw caution to the wind and throw yourself in the line of fire, or why are you fighting?
Move on.
Yeah, move on. John Jones is a fucking phenomenon, man. That dude, as good as he has looked in the past, the fight against Glover was just sensational.
It was masterful.
Yeah.
It was something to behold. I was like, he's amazing in the gym. He's so talented in every respect. You know, like, even I've been doing jiu-jitsu for forever, and He's good. He's really, really good. And then, like, stand-up is a whole different world. His wrestling is just out of this world. Like, and then he goes on game day, on fight day, and he's better.
He improvises.
Dude, it's beautiful.
Yeah, when I asked him about the elbows in tight, like fighting Glover against the cage like that, I just had a fucking feeling that he was improvising that. I was like, is this something you planned out? I was like, no, I just felt it. He was winding up, and I just felt like I could get away with that. Like,
We were in fight camp at the exact same time. I fought 1 week before him, and he didn't drill those. You know, like, we're watching out for Glover's big overhand right. You know, obviously, we're looking for the two, three punch combos that he does in entrances. You know, watching, of course, for Glover's wrestling. He's a beast on top. And then you watch the fight, and you're like, he didn't do that stuff in fight camp. He just, fight night, started improvising and destroying the still number two dude on the planet.
Yeah.
So decisively, it's disturbing.
He also added a new thing to his game that I think you're going to see a lot of people do. That's that attacking the shoulder with that loose underhook.
Yep.
When a guy has that relaxed underhook and you yank that arm up, I mean, he fucked Glover's shoulder up in the first round. He never really recovered.
No, it changed the whole feeling of what Glover could do offensively from that point forward.
Yeah, he it was mangled. Yeah. And now, you know, his labrum's torn.
He's going to have
to get surgery. Yeah. Yeah, it's... John's done a lot of things that a lot of people implement now. The front leg side kick to the thigh. Yeah. There was very few people doing that before him.
No, everybody does it.
He's got to watch the finger pokes, though, man. Yeah. John is always doing that thing where he's extending his hands. And, you know, guys trying to move forward, they wind up running into his fingers all the time.
Yeah, I really do believe – I hate finger pokes, knees to the groin when guys get tired, cage grabbing, like – don't like it at all. So he's a teammate. I really do believe that he doesn't intend to hit them in the eyes. He likes controlling range,
yeah.
And he has that open hand out, you know, to try to set that range and responsively counterattack. And just like you said, guys, just run into it. You know, he's not trying to poke them, but it's his fault because his hand's open and his fingers are freaking pointing up there.
Yeah, I don't think he's doing it intentionally either, but it is an issue.
It has to change.
It happened with Gustafson. It happened with Glover. You know, it's... It's a very tricky situation because on one hand, it's a good tactic. It's a good tactic to try to palm the forehead. And, you know, I mean, it's a big one in Muay Thai. But in Muay Thai, of course, you're dealing with a fully enclosed glove.
Yeah.
I don't know what the fuck they can do, but they really need to do something. It needs to be a priority.
Pride gloves.
Pride gloves.
Yeah, there it is. It's one
of them. Yeah, man, you watch Pride. And I've been watching a lot of Pride lately because I... at home,
awesome.
Yeah, it's fucking awesome. It's just the greatest shit ever. You know, it's really interesting to watch their evolution of the sport, too, when you watch Pride. You watch, like, guys, and you compare them to the best guys of today, and you're like, wow, this is like, there's been a big fucking jump.
Yeah.
A big fucking jump.
I love Don Fry and his mustache. Rest in peace, mustache. But
he shaved it off, I heard. That's crazy.
But, like, Don Fry in Pride compared to, you know, like, the light heavyweights now.
Yeah.
Just the disparity of skill and technical level, even athleticism. And Don was a beast.
Mm-hmm.
It's night and day.
Well, I was watching Vanderlei, the best of Vanderlei in Pride. There was an episode in the best of Pride where it was all Vanderlei's fights. And, you know, Vanderlei is one of my favorite fighters to watch. He's a wild man. But, you know, you compare his skill level to like a guy like John Jones, who they're fighting at the same weight class, you're like, that wouldn't even be a hard fight for John.
That'd be like a round.
Yeah, it would not be. It would be, you can't touch me, and I'm going to keep hitting you, and you're going to not know what to do, and then either you're going to get choked unconscious or beat the fuck up.
Yeah.
It's amazing how much of a jump there's been from 93 to 2014 as far as the evolution of martial arts. And I say it like it's a line that I keep saying, but it's true. In those two decades, martial arts have evolved more than they have in the last 2,000 years.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Absolutely.
It's the longest time, man. You know, I grew up doing martial arts in the 80s, and nobody knew what the fuck worked. It was all just guessing. You know, everybody knew that, you know, if you were a really good wrestler, you could take guys down. And if you were a really good boxer, you could probably punch better. But what would work better, karate or judo? What would work better, jujitsu? Nobody knew. Nobody fucking knew. It was just all guessing.
Guys naming new moves every single card. They're like, oh, what are you going to call this one? Like, how can we progress so quickly where every Saturday night we're like, oh, here's a new submission.
Yeah.
You know, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah, the Peruvian necktie, you know, the Tony D'Souza, which you very rarely see. I mean, CB Dalloway is probably the only, I don't even know if D'Souza's ever pulled it off inside the octagon, but CB Dalloway's pulled it off. There's a few guys that use that Peruvian necktie, and then there's a few chokes that you see them once, and then you never see them again. It's a fascinating thing where you're watching all this stuff evolve right in front of your eyes. How do you manage your training when it comes to like working on new techniques, adding new things to your arsenal, and then still just the conditioning, the sparring, the day-to-day drilling that you have to do? Like, how do you manage stuffing all that stuff in?
Time management, like a good athlete, you know, I do things in like ratios, percentages of, okay, I want to develop or give a certain percentage of time to getting better. So I'm going to, you know, let's say I have 10 classes a week, just easy round number. In those 10 classes, you know, like I want two or three of them to be exclusively focused on drilling new techniques. You know, then I want two or three of them to be maintenance of things that I do well and want to continue to do well. And there's just grappling, like in a 1 week, 10 class setting. And then, you know, two or three of them are hard grappling, rolling, sparring type sessions. You know, then the other one's like maybe a floater of I'm teaching or I'm working with just, you know, a handful of black belts trying to create new stuff. You know, so like it's equally proportionate to staying good, challenging myself physically, and developing new technique and learning, you know.
What about recovery? Like, what about what
screw
do you
that
do?
Stuff. Recovery.
It's for pussies.
Yeah, it's for the birds.
What do you do? Do you have like a routine as far as like deep tissue massage,
yes.
cryotherapy?
Yes.
What do you do?
Yes to both of those.
All those.
Yeah. So Austin cryotherapy, I'm there.
Is that one of those things you stand in one of those chambers and it's
like
50 below zero
like
or something
negative
crazy?
300.
Is that crazy?
Yeah.
What happens to your dick when you do that? That seems to me to be a problem.
So I have gloved fingers.
Right.
And I take those gloved fingers and I cover what is going to be my very small penis in like seconds, you know, and I make sure I like double hand it. So both my hands are like
good
double
move.
Insulated. Yeah.
Does anybody go raw dog and just let their dick freeze? That would be because if you found out that guy did it, you'd probably have to do it too, wouldn't you?
No,
I would assume that you would be one of those guys that'd be like, all right,
I am that
fuck.
Dumb.
Yeah,
it's true. Like, I am so stupid. I'm gonna, did you really? Are you messing with me? Fuck it.
Fuck.
I'm gonna do it.
Yeah, just do it in a monk position.
You're only in there for like 3 minutes,
right?
And then you get out, huge infusion of blood, you feel better. Like,
what's the Eddie Bravo did this in preparation for his Hoyler match, which is the first time I'd heard about it. Like, explain it to me and for the lay people at home. It's your neck is above, right? Your head is exposed.
Yeah.
So it closes on you like a sun tanning bed.
Exactly. But you're standing up.
Right.
They punch liquid nitrogen gas in there, so up to like about your chin, down to like negative 300 degrees. So you're breathing, the gas is coming up to your chin, and you know, the largest organ in your body is your skin. So it's very responsive. You know, it can absorb quickly. You know, like people take drugs that way. You know, you can also, it's very responsive. So it gets exposed to negative 300 degrees. The first thing it does is take blood from the extremities and rushes it to the vital life sustaining organs of your body, your brain, your heart, and your lungs. So all the blood goes from your extremities to your core, and then you get and you're there for like 2-3 minutes. And super crazy, because if you have an injury like a hurt knee or a hurt hand, where you have extra fluid there, it gets super cold there because you have more fluid there, and more fluid is conductive and it gets colder faster. So you can feel these injuries on your body get crazy cold. And then you hop out, 3 minutes is up, you get out of the chamber, and then your body responds to being in 80 degrees, and all the blood rushes back out to the extremities. So you get this huge infusion of good, healthy blood back out to these injuries and back out to your extremities. And it's a rush. It feels like you just drank like 5 cups of coffee and you're like amped, and it's just this weird, tingly, fantastic sensation. So that's what happens.
And how does it help you recover by doing that?
Infusion, circulation, like trying to treat an injury. You know, you have rest, ice, compression, elevation. You know, when you're trying to work on recovery without injury, you want circulation. So you want good, healthy blood going to muscles that you've just fatigued to increase recovery and response time. So like if you just like simple terms. If I went and did like a big squat and deadlift workout for the day, right? My legs and back and butt are going to be sore. You know, those extremities it's vascular region. So go hop in the cryo chamber. All the blood that's sitting there in that area, in my legs and my back and my butt, all rush to my brain and lungs and heart. And then I get out, and all sorts of great, new, fantastic blood goes back to my legs, back, and butt. So I get a great, huge infusion of good, healthy blood back out to my extremities to increase recovery time, because I'm just increasing circulation. Increasing circulation is increasing recovery.
Wow, that's fascinating shit, man. It's fascinating when you see all these new innovations when it comes to strength and conditioning and recovery and fitness, and that's a unique one, man. That's interesting stuff.
It's cold, though.
Yeah. How many days a week do you do that?
Like 4.
Wow. Yeah, and they have a place like that in Albuquerque?
No, they don't. They have a trailer that sometimes they'll bring out to me in fight camps.
That has that in it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
That is super nice.
Wow. So Albuquerque doesn't have that?
Nope.
Greg Jackson, get on the ball, bitch. I know. Come on. You should have that.
Fantastic. Yep. Deep tissues, great. I believe like the tenets, the foundations of being a healthy, recovering athlete, you know, like good sleep, good food, good sex, you know, like you have to have those. And if you're doing those things, then your body's going to adapt to whatever the workload of volume that you're putting out. So I have a crazy volume. Like guys that come and train with me, they're like, this is normal. Yeah, this is normal. Like this is what I do normally. But I just have a very healthy foundation of a lifestyle, you know, like where I don't really drink. I don't ever smoke. You know, like I train every single day, 2-3 times a day. Like this is, my body's adaptive to that. And then everything else, the supporting structure of eating well, you know, having awesome supplements, you know, having everything just to make my body respond properly to training volume is there.
So, how do you work your diet out? What do you have a nutritionist that you work with? Do you do it on your own?
A little bit of all of the above. You know, like I have nutritionists that I bounce stuff off of, and like people that are way smarter than me. That, and then I'm surrounded with so many other elite athletes talking to them and their coaches. You know, the guys that on it. You know, they have a stable of guys there that are always looking for the next best thing, or even not the next best thing. Things that are just have been there around for thousands of years that nobody uses like they should. So it's a constant discussion of like how to improve. I know what my calories that I'm burning in a day because I log everything. You know, I fought 2 weeks ago, so I was on crazy strict diet for like 3-4 months to get down to 185. So now I'm back in Austin, Texas. Maybe I'll have a little bit of brisket. It's getting in there, you know, or you know, some tacos. So, which I think is actually needed. You know, you can't be perfect all the time. Your body needs those cheats.
Yeah, I agree. I think cheat days are important. I think people that are just completely clean and strict, you're robbing yourself also of enjoyment.
Yeah, life's too short not to enjoy it.
Yeah, there's some delicious food that you shouldn't eat all the time, but you should eat sometimes. Yeah. Definitely, right?
Yeah.
So do you, when you say that you log the amount of calories that you burn, how do you calculate that?
So heart rate monitor, right, during the workout – knows my resting metabolic rate, you know, is key. You have to know what that is. And once you know what that is, kind of in between workouts, you know cumulatively in a day what you've burnt. And then you just add during the workouts, you know, if I work out 2 or 3 times that day, you know, if I'm doing a 90-minute strength and conditioning session, you know, I'm going to burn anywhere between 12 to 1600 calories in that session, you know, from warm up to cool down. You know, then I'll, like last night I had a 2-hour jiu-jitsu session, you know, like, and it smashed afterwards. You know, like, I know what my heart rate was at during the entire time in 2 hours. You know, that's going to be another 1,500 calories that I'm putting on top of what I burnt in that day. So I get a snapshot that I burnt, you know, 5,500 to 6,000 calories.
That's insane.
Yeah.
That's way more than most people eat in a day.
Yeah. It's fun to eat that, though.
How do you stuff that in, though? I mean, how much? What do you? What
I'm
are you
in
doing
Austin, Texas.
Brisket.
So easy.
Do you have any other like nutritional requirements? Like, do you eat gluten? Do you take sugar into your diet at all?
I try not to. Definitely fight camp. I don't have either of those. You know, but like right now, you know, I had an apple fritter bagel on Monday. Like, I hadn't had one of those in, I don't even know how long. And it was amazing. It was like a small orgasm in my mouth. You know?
I don't even know what that is, an apple fritter bagel.
No, not bagel, just an apple fritter.
Oh, okay.
Apple fritter donut.
Oh, okay. Oh. So it's like just donut with apples.
Yeah, and gluten and sugar and apples.
Sugar, but, yeah. And that sort of what is that syrupy stuff in with the apples and the cinnamon?
That's exactly.
Ooh, that sounds good.
It was good.
Shit. Do you Krispy Kreme it? Do you ever Krispy Kreme it?
No.
You don't go Krispy Kreme?
No.
Damn, dude.
I know.
There's a spot that I go to. I'm getting Regenikine. Do you know what that is?
It's
a thing that they go to Germany for. That Dr. Peter Weller invented. It's a blood spinning procedure.
Oh, yeah. You know, NFL guys are doing it too.
Yes. I've been getting it done. I had it done on my neck. I had a bulging disc in my neck that was impinging on nerves. I was getting some numbness in my hand from jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
Went away totally.
Magic.
The thing just shrunk down to nothing. But the place where I get it is right down the street from Krispy Kreme. And I drive, and I'm like, do I want to fuck up what I just fixed?
Just do it.
Inflammation, you know? Apparently inflammation, and I found out about it from a physical therapist, that gluten and inflammation, they're like, people say, oh, you know, you're not really gluten sensitive. Most people aren't. I mean, you can eat gluten and you'd be fine, but the reality is it does cause some inflammation.
Yeah, more you eat, the more you get.
Yeah, that's a fascinating thing, that it's a normal part of everybody's diet. You wouldn't think that it would have that sort of an effect on your joints or your back, but it really does.
Yeah, well, especially if, you know, like they train like we do.
Yeah.
You know, like then now we're just compounding problems where we have the enablers to cause inflammation, and then we're diet giving something that helps cause it. You know, now things are just compounded and it's exponential, and then we're just like, I'm so
What small. About dairy?
Not much at all. Some cheeses I just can't live without. You know.
Cheeses? You're a cheese guy?
No, I mean, yes. I'm a food guy. If it's good, I want it.
Yeah, you cook, right?
Oh, God, I love to cook.
What kind of, what do you cook?
I love everything, but I love cooking like real. When I say real, it's my food that I shot. It's that I cleaned, that I froze, that I packaged, that I brought in from my greenhouse, my backyard, you know, like my food.
Right.
So
I'm with you 1,000%.
I love being connected to what I put in my body.
Yeah, there's very few people who have experienced that, haven't said that it's something special.
Yeah.
That when you cook an animal that you actually hunted, shot, butchered, cut up, put in your freezer, or eat it in camp, which is even better, when you're eating it like a couple hours after it died, this is an amazing connection that, you know, people will poo-poo that, like it's not important, like, you know, oh, you're just using that as an excuse to go out and shoot animals. Like,
no.
Man, I really wish those folks, I would really like to take someone who's a meat eater, who's anti-hunting, and just, you need to just experience this.
I 100% agree. I wish every person that ate meat, and ironically, like a ton of anti-hunters, like, eat meat, obviously.
Yeah.
There's no connection to food these days. Like, people just want to go to the grocery store and pick their stuff off the shelf and have no idea how it got there, what was put in there, you know, but then they judge me because I hunt.
Mm-hmm.
But I know exactly where this animal came from, you know, and like, I felt sorry for it when I shot it and I thought it was beautiful and I still do. And I'm enjoying every single bite of it, but they're going to sit there and be like, oh man, that guy hunts, you know, like I'm an absolute fanatic conservationist, but I hunt. Yeah. And I love my food and I love good food. So they're all connected. And I think people should wake up and realize.
It's also what we were talking about earlier, is that there's a broad spectrum of things that are going on in this world. There's no black and white when it comes to hunting. You can actually love animals and still shoot them and kill them.
I love them.
Isn't that? It's a crazy thing. Like, people have, they find that like impossibly contradictory.
Yeah.
But it's not. And it's also the other thing that people don't want to admit is that if you do not shoot these animals, they're going to continue to fuck, they're going to continue to procreate, and then how are you going to control the population? Because you have two options. Either you can hunt them or you can bring in wolves.
Yeah.
So what do you want to do? You want wolves wandering around through your fucking neighborhood killing everything that they can get a hold of, including dogs, including livestock? Do you want wild panthers? What do you want? How are you going to control the populations of these animals that don't have natural predators?
The first, my experience, I was like a prepubescent kid when Catalina Island off the coast here of California, somebody accidentally introduced a hog to Catalina, and it mated and boned with maybe one or two other wild hogs that were there that created this feral big ass hog that made a whole bunch of shit tons of more hogs and then started destroying the entire island. So they brought in hunters to get rid of these hogs that were destroying the entire ecosystem of that island. And that happens on a much more, that's the micro example on a tiny little island with a tiny little animal. But if you look at the big picture of, you know, like deer in the South or hogs from Florida to Texas, you know, like, or the python that was introduced to in the Everglades, they have to be hunted to maintain the balance of harmony in the ecosystem. And, you know, if the ecosystem will crash if it's not done. So you either, like you said, give a predator, and that predator has serious problems that come along with it, or you have the hunter that does it properly, and then you have the benefits that come along with it, which is a proper ecosystem.
And you get delicious wild ham. Look at that. Yeah, delicious. I smoked that bitch myself. Look at that.
That's so
in my
beautiful.
Backyard. I shot it and I smoked it, and it was the best tasting ham ever. Wild pig has a completely different texture
than anything.
I marinated it or brined it rather for 7 days before I smoked it. But even so, it's like it's a more dense meat. It's more muscle. It's darker. It tastes better. It's better for you. And you fucking have to kill them because there's 50,000 hogs. The place where I go to is Tejon Ranch, only an hour and a half outside of L.A. And they have elk. They have a pond up there that they put a trail camera on just to see what's eating there. 16 different mountain lions. Oh, nothing. Just 16 different fucking wild murderous cats. And it's because there's so many pigs. There's so much game up there.
You could, in from Texas to Florida, you could bring in every hunter in the nation and have them kill 10 pigs apiece, and it wouldn't even dent.
Yeah,
what's the population of wild hogs in the Southeast?
Have you ever seen Apocalypse Now?
No, it sounds like the best movie ever.
It's a show. There's a dude. His name is Brian Quokka, I think is his name.
That's a great name.
Yeah,
Quokka.
He's a guy from Texas, and he's got a show called Pigman. And Pigman is a hunter in Texas, and he hunts wild pigs, and then he owns a barbecue place, and then serves up wild pig barbecue. Now he's got a show on one of those, like, history or something like that. It's called Boss Hog, and the show sort of details what he's doing.
I'm familiar with it.
Him and Ted Nugent got helicopters with fucking machine guns, and they're flying around with ARs shooting pigs out of the sky. I mean, it is the craziest fucking thing I've ever seen on TV.
That's legal now.
Yeah.
We passed
They have to do it.
Yeah.
You have to. And for folks who don't, that's cruel, that's horrible. There are
millions
of pigs,
and they don't care.
And they not only that, they don't stop fucking. They breed all year round. It's not like deer that have a rut and then they'll have a fawn. No, these are animals that are shitting out 4 or 5 pigs every 4 or 5 months.
Yeah,
and they just don This is the video of them shooting these things from the sky. There's actually companies. This is the wrong one. What you're showing is there's a pig hunting video. That was a pig hunting promo for the Sportsman's Channel. But this is they had a whole episode, and in the episode they killed 450 pigs in a fucking 22-minute episode with commercials.
Yeah, but that's like that's a drop
in
the ocean.
Yeah.
To what's there.
Yeah, literally, it is like taking a shot glass and tossing it into the ocean. I mean, it's the most ridiculous thing you've ever seen in your life. And they're just and they're catching these pigs running, headshots where they're tumbling while they're running, and there's something barbaric and fucked up about it. But they're taking that food and they're feeding hungry people. They have hunters for the hungry. They give the wild pork, which is excellent meat. They give it to hungry families, and it's really, really, really delicious food. Yeah. And it's important too. But then there's that thing where people are like, well, that's fucked up, man. That's not really hunting. They're shooting. They're not really hunting. Yeah. They're eradicating these problematic, delicious animals. That's the best way to look at it.
They have to be eradicated. And while it might not be the most humane approach to it, it's a necessary one that has to happen.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know, like, it's a necessary evil a little bit.
Well, do you know what's going on in the Hamptons? You know, the Hamptons, the luxury area outside of Long Island where all these rich folks. They have so many deer up there that they're bringing in snipers. They're bringing snipers in the middle of the night. And the town has proposed to give these deer birth control, to somehow or another give them food, put food out that has birth control in it, which, by the way, the male deer are going to eat too. Yeah. So you're going to make bitches out of the male deer. The male deer are going to run around, I think I'm fucking pregnant.
Why are my nipples swollen? So you're gonna,
natural?
Yeah, so you're going to have these male deer that are eating birth control, female deer, and it's going to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. And it's a direct result of the failure to eradicate these animals or control their population through hunting. Yeah. There's a place in Pennsylvania where they have 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week hunting 365 days a year. You can hunt with bows and arrows. You can hunt all years around because there are so many deer. They're like, just fucking bring in hunters. And the hunters come in, and there's these huge estates that have these, you know, like 10-acre properties where there's fucking tree stands. These million-dollar houses with fucking putting green courses and dudes in tree stands launching arrows at deer because they're fucking everywhere. They're like tree squirrels, like ground squirrels. You ever drive into like a ranch that has ground squirrels, and as the car is running, you see like
thousands of them just run across the road.
It's incredible.
Yeah,
like Tejon Ranch, which has 50,000 hogs. It has Rocky Mountain elk, gigantic elk. They have thousands of deer. They have bears. They have mountain lions. They have everything. The number one animal mass, pound for pound, is ground squirrels. And this 2,700,000 acre ranch, number one is ground squirrels.
Believe it. My dad, and he was a narcotics officer for 30 years, door kicking superstar. He spends his retired time now shooting ground squirrels. He is like the most amazing setup
for ground squirrels.
For ground squirrels,
but you can't even eat ground squirrels.
No, on the ranch, like the cows will step in their holes,
they break
their
legs. Yeah.
Or they destroy irrigation for the vineyards. Like.
Mm-hmm.
They're nasty. They're disease carrying, and they also breed like crazy. You can't stop them. They're cannibals too.
Mm-hmm.
Like you shoot one, they'll like drag it into the hole and eat it.
Yeah, they're very different from tree squirrels.
Yeah,
tree squirrels are actually good. I've eaten tree squirrel. They're delicious.
They're pretty.
They taste good, man. Mm. Steve Rinella, the guy who was the host of Meat Eater, shot a squirrel when we were in Wisconsin and cooked it. And it was really. It's a very unique taste too. It doesn't taste like anything else. But ground squirrels, man.
I wouldn't eat one.
Yeah. Apparently you can't. Apparently they're just fucking disgusting.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, I guess you could eat it if you were starving to death, but another problem is if you shoot them, you have to kill them. Because if you shoot them and you wound them, they run into their hole and then the other ones eat it.
Yeah.
Fucking creepy
little. Yeah, they're nasty.
There's a lot of creepy little animals out there.
Yep.
But this, I mean, the idea that this one ranch with 2,700,000 acres.
Their largest
animal mass is ground squirrels. Well, they say that the largest mass of life on Earth, moving life, is ants. And that there's more pounds of ants than there are humans. Pounds of humans. It's incredible.
Yeah. And they're like 10,000 times stronger than we are.
Yeah.
Percent ratio.
Yeah.
I hope they never get mad at us.
Or they better not start growing. You know, if you go back throughout the history and you find some of the animals that were just really enormous just a few hundred million years ago and they've somehow or another shrunk down to a manageable size.
Yeah,
like if bees are the size of horses, we'd have real problems.
Yeah. But I love honey.
Yeah, honey's delicious. You know, vegans don't eat honey.
That's horrible.
That's hilarious.
That's a
it's hilarious. Yeah. Just show, if you ever want to know how retarded being a vegan is, you won't eat honey.
I know they're retarded the moment that they start with "I'm a vegan." You know,
well, they can't help say it. It's like they're holding
they
a hot
marathons.
Pan. They run marathons.
Yeah, it's like the other thing that comes out right away is like "I'm a marathoner" or "I'm a vegan" or "I eat paleo" or "I'm a CrossFit." That's like nobody can help but tell you those necessary elements of themselves.
Yeah, what is that?
I don't know what it is.
It's they want to tell you they're awesome.
But to me, that almost discounts you as being such.
Yeah, if you're a vegan and you cannot tell people for a long period of time, that's super impressive.
Yeah, I'll like you more. You know? Wow, you're a vegan and it took you 2 weeks to tell me? I'm impressed. Can I buy you lunch? A vegan lunch.
I get it for people that don't want to be cruel. I totally get the whole sentiment. I get all of it. I get the idea of like wanting to eat fresh vegetables and it's healthy for you. I get it. But the finite nature of life itself, it seems to me it's so silly that you think that somehow or another you not killing animals is somehow going to balance things out, or you not being a part of killing animals is going to balance. They're killing each other. Do you know that? Like there's a war going on. All the animals are involved in it, including humans. We're just so far ahead we forgot it's a war. And we have POW camps that we set up in cities. We call them zoos. And that's what that is. That those they didn't ask to be there.
I like this.
We analogy. Capture those motherfuckers and we put them, and they're in these weird things where we don't let them interact with the other animals in the zoo. We block them off in their own little apartments, and you know, so we could stare at them while we eat popcorn. I'm not sure I agree with that.
I don't.
I think that if you should have zoos, you should lump all those bitches together. And if you run out of monkeys, go get more. So the monkeys
There's
that
a lot
survive,
of those, too.
The monkeys that survive are going to be the ones that know how to get away from the cats.
Yeah, he's a badass. Oh, that monkey I want as a pet.
Yeah, that's a monkey who knows how to zig and zag. He knows how to juke. You know, when the cat's coming, he knows how to get to the tall branches.
Yeah.
The monkey that stays on the ground and picks his ass while the jaguar is slowly creeping up on him, that's the monkey that's supposed to die.
The only the weird part about the SeaWorlds and the zoos of this of our life is that they do. I love when people are like, oh, did you see the movie Blackfish? You know, like, it's so horrible. I'm going to boycott SeaWorld. You're like, have you ever given a cent to marine biology or the preservation of marine wildlife? No, but you're going to boycott SeaWorld. How much money have they given in the research and preservation of marine wildlife? Oh yeah, 1,000 times more than you. It's the same with the zoos. You know, like, I don't like zoos. I think it's horrible that the animals are there, but they do more in research and understanding wildlife and the preservation of wildlife than almost everyone that goes there and then or doesn't go there and complains about it. And so it's just like this, again, shades of gray.
My problem with SeaWorld is very simple. Those animals are smart. They're very smart. In fact, the cerebral cortex of a dolphin is 40% larger than that of a human being.
Beautiful.
We don't even understand how smart they are because they can't alter their environment. So we don't think of them as being smart because they don't have thumbs, they don't pick things up. Because they can move in 3D all around the ocean. They can fucking dive and swim and move around, and they have these pods. They stay together. They have families. They have dialects. They have languages. They're so intelligent that we're just now starting to understand that they have variations in the way they speak depending upon what geographic location they're at. They're really fucking smart, like human-type smart. And just because they're different from us and they don't build houses doesn't mean they're not smart.
Yeah.
So to me, it's like slavery. It's like just because, you know, well, we have donated so much money into slavery research, but you're still fucking slave owners, you cunts. You know, the reason why there needs to be slavery research, I just think that anything smart shouldn't be in captivity. But like giraffes,
they're so stupid.
You go to the zoo and they seem happy as fuck.
They're as
babies
happy there,
feed them. They let babies feed them. I have a 3-year-old. She holds up lettuce. The giraffe comes and take it. That fucking giraffe's not upset at all.
No.
They're so confident that giraffes are chill that they let babies feed them. You know?
They are. They are so chill.
They're just happy there's no lions.
No.
For you to be a giraffe all day, you have a giant target. Your neck is just this huge target.
You're a beacon
that somebody wants to bite.
Yep.
There's not one spot. It's not like a warthog that is this little short fucking stubby neck. It's tough to get to. You have this giant neck like a tree. Everywhere around it, you could bite and kill you. I mean, they're so happy they're in the zoo. They're so happy.
No, they don't know how happy they are. They're like, wait, nothing's eating me? And this 3-year-old's giving me food?
Yeah.
Okay. I think this is good.
But then there's weirdness when it comes to captive animals like these hunting camps that they have in Africa. It gets, again, the gray area, the weirdness of the world, because you know Louis Theroux, the documentary guy?
Yeah.
Fascinating guy. Had him on the podcast. Really, really interesting cat.
I'm going to watch that one.
It's a good one. Yeah. One of the best documentaries that he did was when he went to Africa and went to these hunting camps.
Mm-hmm.
They have these high-fence hunting camps where they take these animals and they put them in these huge enclosures and they let people hunt them. The irony is these animals are – there's higher populations. They're healthier. There's more of them. Animals that were on the verge of extinction are now – there's many, many, many of them. But – they're hunted.
Yeah.
So it's like people have this weird sort of like, well, yeah, the animals are healthier, the populations are healthier, but the reason being is because people can pay to go kill them. Like, whoa. But it's just another example of the world not being so clear-cut. There's a lot of weirdness out there.
Yep. Ironically, some of the rhinos that are left in this world are at those camps. They're not being hunted. They're being protected. They're in these high fence, game fence areas where people are coming. They'll come look at the rhino and be like, oh, wow, what a beautiful rhino. All right, let's go shoot a gemsbuck and a kudu. How much does it cost? You know, like something they couldn't do 20 years ago because there weren't enough of them. But now, like, oh, limitless impala? Well, that's a blessed buck? Oh, I'll take one of those. That's $1,000? Not a problem. You know, like, that's what it's like there. But they saved species by making them available to be paid for.
Yeah, it's very strange. And Louis Theroux's documentary really captured
it. What was his
it.
Position?
Well, his position is, you know, he's the trying to get evil? To it. He's trying to get to his position during the whole documentary. He's like, I see. But the real position is really clearly established by the guy who runs the hunting camp, because he gets angry at Louis at one point in the show, like, you know, three quarters of the way in. He goes, "You don't understand." He goes, "Africa is fucked." He goes, "It's fucked. And unless something is worth money, it's going to fucking die. They fucking kill everything. It's fucked. There's nothing here. The reason why these fucking animals are here is because they're worth money. Yeah. That's it. That's it. Do you understand?" And, you know, Louis is like, "I guess. I understand."
But it's true.
It is true. It is true. Yeah. And in a sense, that sort of mirrors what's going on when it comes to wildlife in America. More money has been spent by hunters to conserve wetlands, to preserve wildlife habitat for elk, to preserve areas where deer live, and to establish clear protocols as far as how many animals can be sustained in any given location and keep the populations healthy. All that money comes from hunters.
Yeah.
Which is just amazing. It's just, it's another one of those things. It's like when you look at it in like clear, objective terms, you see that this is a very complex issue. And it's not as simple as, "These animals are beautiful. We should not kill them." Like,
they are beautiful.
Yeah, you have to kill them, though.
But you have to kill them.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Right?
It sucks.
It's not really. They're delicious. I know. That's the crazy thing is, no, not, it doesn't really suck. They are delicious. Like, fuck, man. There's so much going on there. And it, again, it's just the way the world is.
Yeah.
The world.
Which is like this ironic contrast to the first 10 years of my life where, like, I didn't think what I was shooting was beautiful because they're evil fuckers. You know, so like now as a, like a sportsman, a hunter, like, I love these animals. And
which animals do you think were evil?
Terrorists.
But when you said for the first 10 years of your life, you're shooting terrorists?
No, 10 years of my career. Oh. Like, as a shooter.
Oh, I thought you were saying as your life.
Wait, so when,
like,
you're 9 years old?
You were hunting terrorists at nine?
No, like, at 23. You know, I was like, no remorse, slept very well at night, you know, because like, these were evil people.
Right.
And now I'm like, oh, man, I don't want to shoot that. That's pretty. Mm-hmm. You know, that thing's beautiful. That I'll shoot, you know, because that is really yummy and there's too many of them. Yeah.
Yeah, I have a buddy who served and came back, and he loves fishing, and he had a real hard time getting back into hunting. He said, you know, you see so much death at a certain point in time, you don't want to be a part of
totally
any of it.
Totally sympathize.
Yeah. Yeah. He got back. He lives in New Mexico, and he got back into elk hunting. New Mexico is great for elk. He got back into it after a while, but it took him a while. It took him a while to just sort of settle in. He just, like, I saw too much death.
Yeah. Totally empathetic to that.
Is there ever going to be a time where there's no war? Is that even possible with human beings?
Not in my lifetime.
That's a disturbing idea for people, because if people have this idea, I mean, this is a shitty analogy, but it's one that I use. If 20 people can get along, if, like, okay, there's five of us in this room or four of us in this room. If there's four people in this room and we can get along, can 40 people get along? Yes, 40 people can get along. You could have a community of 40 people with no problems and just live from birth to death, and everybody, you know, nobody kills anybody.
Maybe that weird outlier at 40, but, you know, as a community, they'll absorb him for what he is or whatever.
Yeah, but then you get to 4,000.
No.
No. Jim's someone's going to die.
Yeah.
So Jim's a douche.
Yep.
We got to take out Jim. You know, and everybody's going to meet by the campfire and go, "Look, this motherfucker is just ruining our life. He doesn't hunt. He eats all our food. He fucks our women when we're not there. He beats our kids. We got to kill this guy." And there's out of like a certain number, there's going to be this one that comes up. And then when you deal with seven billion, it's like, whoa, how does that ever become manageable? I mean, do human beings have to evolve past what we are right now? Do we have to reach some new stage? Yeah, I hope so too.
Yeah.
Well, you would know better than anybody what the horrors of war are. So would you think that someone who has experienced that would have a better perspective about what's necessary and what's not necessary when it comes to sort of just managing peace?
Yes and no. You know, there's no like nirvanic moment where you have like this clear sight of, you know, what an understanding of what's necessary and what's not, how people should be or how people shouldn't be. Like, if anything, you know, as 6 years as a door kicker assaulter and then 4 years as a Halo sniper guy, I've seen death like from a foot away and from a mile away. You know, so like there's no range of death I haven't seen. So if anything, like I value life more, I think. I hate war more. Like I know, like I think it's horrible and disgusting, but without a doubt, I think it's absolutely necessary and needed to such a level that I can't even imagine what this world would be like had we not been involved to the degree that we've been involved in for the past 12 years, trying to eradicate this fanatic group of psychopaths. So I don't want to think about what the world would be like, but you know, I don't want my nieces and my nephews or my kids to ever have to do what I did or see what I saw. So I don't know. Like, I hope we never have to invade a country. You know, I remember we were talking about Syria. You're like, are we going to go over there? I was like, God, no. You know, there's no need. There's no resource. There's no necessary element for us to be involved in. But the preservation of human life, isn't that needed? You know, is it?
Right.
Well,
that's one of the reasons why false flags and false flag operations are so disgusting. When you find out that someone's lying about the motivation for profit. And that
there's nothing worse than somebody that lies for the benefit of themselves. Like, Joe, I think you're a good looking man,
Thank you.
And I think that dress looks great on you and it makes you look thin. That's an okay lie sometimes to tell,
right.
You know, wait, it's your 28th birthday. You know, that's great to hear. You know, no, I'm 40 or whatever, you know, like those are not self-serving lies.
Those are cute lies.
Yeah. But when you're lying so that you can put money in your pocket at the expense of human life, I hope you burn in hell forever.
It's a dark lie.
No,
it's a very, very dark lie. It's a confusing lie too, because it's like, wait a minute. This has actually happened. When you find out about the Gulf of Tonkin or Operation Northwoods, that there have been these moments in time where people have tried to figure out a way to lie in order to drag people into war, a war that otherwise the public wouldn't support. It's dark. It's a very weird aspect of society that not only that exists, but that's ignored. It's ignored and almost brushed under the table when you start talking about war and about policy. There's something that people don't want to acknowledge, that we have been duped by the military-industrial complex in the past, and that it is actually standard operational procedure.
Yeah.
That they will come up with different ways in order to get people to support war, and one of them is the lie.
Yeah.
Yeah. When guys come back, the big one is PTSD. That's the hardest aspect, it seems, to integrate back into a normal society with normal life and normal jobs and normal, just the things that we all just deal with on a regular basis. For some folks, it becomes almost unbearable. What is the difference between people that integrate smoothly and people that have an incredibly difficult time?
You know, from that incredibly difficult time to smoothly are all scales, you know, and the biggest or the factors are the degrees of coping mechanisms that an individual has. I have a very strong family, you know, like an amazing wife, fantastic father and mother. They're still married, amazing brother and sister. Great. Like, so the family unit, very supportive. I'm very fit. I'm very healthy. I'm well educated. I was well trained. These are all different mechanisms to deal with stress. Everybody deals with stress differently, but the foundation of how you deal with stress, you have to have these fundamental elements to be able to do it. The more of them that you have, the more stress you can deal with. So a guy like me that was Ranger, sniper, Green Beret, like killed lots of dudes, can come back and sleep well at night. You know, yeah, I had to adjust. There are things that, you know, like I had moments where a guy smoking a clove that maybe just ate at an Indian restaurant. So I'm having some sensory to like how he smells, listening to, you know, music from that culture that I just spent six months with, you know, like, I'm like, I want to shoot this person, like that instant reaction. But then I'm like, okay, no, everything's okay.
Wow, what is that like?
It's weird. I was walking into a Best Buy, and that was an exact example. This guy driving a yellow BMW, he was smoking a clove, and I got this whiff of like curry. And so everything was there, like the music, the look, what he was wearing, you know. I was just like, that guy looks like a terrorist. Snap judgment. Like, I just got back a couple of days later, and I was like, should I shoot this person?
Wow.
No, I'm in Fayetteville, North Carolina, walking into a Best Buy to buy the new Avengers movie. No, I think it was Iron Man. I don't remember what it was.
But you were an educated guy, and you're an intelligent, introspective guy. For a guy who's not, that's very problematic.
So those coping mechanisms, like, how much does that person have? You have a National Guardsman that enlisted out of high school, him comes from a broken home. He's poor, you know. Then he goes, he enlisted to be a truck driver, and then his truck gets blown up, and they get in a firefight, and then he sees death. He saw, you know, the guy that his navigator just lost an arm. Dude, that guy is scarred for life. You know, he has no coping mechanisms to deal. And then he comes home, and he's broken, and he's damaged. You know, like, how does that person reintegrate into society without all the necessary coping mechanisms? Man, that's hard.
When you hear about stories where guys snap, and there have been several over the course of these two wars, and one of the big ones was a decorated guy wound up killing a bunch of civilians, and it made a lot of the rounds on these talk shows where people trying to discuss like PTSD and traumatic events, and that this guy was. He was having real problems and reporting having real problems before all this happened, and they kept sending him back over there. Do you relate to that, and you try to figure it out for yourself? Like, when you see these stories in the news, like, how do they hit you?
I wish I could be empathetic to, you know, like, I've had PTSD nightmares where I wake up in a sweat, you know, and, like, I put my hand through the wall. You know, my wife's like, are you okay? You know, like, that was years ago, you know, and like, first came back after, you know, some bad, rough trips. So maybe I have some empathy to that. But the Special Forces unit by design is very tight. And, you know, like, if you're having issues, I can go to my team sergeant or I can go to my senior and bounce things off of them. I get really resentful over people making snap judgments about these guys that are coming back and having issues. You know, like, oh, wait, you're a veteran. Is it safe for my kids to be around you? Mm. You know, like, hell yeah, they're like the greatest human beings on the planet, you know, and like one in a million have, not one in a million, a very small percentage have serious issues. But we have to have our eyes wide open about how to deal with post-traumatic stress. And there's not one easy solution, and it's a lot of hard work to get there.
It's not one easy solution. There's not one standard set of experiences that each veteran experiences over there and brings back with them. It varies. And that's such an important thing that you said about the coping mechanisms that you have in place. What's done to help veterans when they come back, as far as like help them strengthen their coping mechanisms, help them deal with situations? What kind of support do they offer you?
So now, you know, we've been at war for a long time. We have a lot of things in place where, you know, FRG, the Family Readiness Group, is there for your family. So when you're coming back, that your family has an understanding of what you've experienced or how to deal with you, you know, like, you know, not, hey, Saturday, you're going to be coaching kids softball. Saturday night, you know, we have this, we're going to mom and dad's for, you know, they're not like overwhelming you with like American life, which is normal to everybody else, unless you've been in a, you know, plywood building for 12 months and now you're back surrounded with like thousands of people that you have no idea. It's weird. So the military has done a way better job of trying to reintegrate soldiers back into, you know, normal life. But then you have a lot of great organizations that are veteran started, and these guys really get it. You know, like Brian Stan is a great example. Hire Heroes, you know, he's involved with getting these guys back to work. Veterans Outdoors, like a Make-A-Wish Foundation for wounded guys. So like, if you have a serious physical ailment from, you know, battle, whether it's internal or physical, they'll give you these crazy things just to be like, hey, things are okay. You're still surrounded by friends. Let's get you reconnected to a community that you're involved with and do something fun at the same time. So there's a lot of different ways. Like, the worst thing though is when they start throwing pills at these guys. you know, the pharmaceutical approach, where it's like, oh, all right, let's get, put you on an antidepressant and, you know, like, hope for the best.
There's a lot of that, right?
It's freaking retarded.
When you're over there, do they try to offer it to you when you're actually in country?
Not like antidepressants. You know, there's pharmaceutical things like to keep you awake longer, to make you alert longer.
Like what kind of shit?
I mean, just like you're in special forces. Like, hey, here's, you know, this. Well, I mean, even some great stuff where like over the counter things. Like, I wish I had Alpha Brain when I was there. Like, not plugging intentionally, but like that stuff's fantastic. You're focused. You feel good. You're ready to go. You know, that would have been 1,000 times better than, you know, like, hey, here's something the DOD just sent down for us to use. You know, it'll keep you awake for 3 days. Awesome.
Like what did they give you?
Like, so I have no idea.
You don't even know what they were?
No, not really.
Whoa.
Yeah. But I know I was awake for 3 days.
You know? Yeah, I have friends who went over there and said they just gave them steroids. They gave them oral steroids.
Well, do you know what? I've never done steroids. Like, I swear by all that's holy and true. Were they offered and available? Yeah. You know, but we have a special forces guy. He's 38 years old. This is his, you know, 6th, 7th combat tour. We're doing 2, 3, 4 hits a night. Hits like missions. You know, we're doing mission, follow-up mission, follow-up mission. We're doing a helicopter, you know, landing. We're doing a gaff where we're on a ground assault force. And this guy's broken. He's hurt. He physically can't keep up. He needs it. You know, and do I want the 38-year-old dude next to me that's on steroids, or do I want the one that can barely walk because everything hurts so bad? I want the 38-year-old on steroids.
Yeah, and that sort of brings up what we were talking about before, where it's the discussion of TRT when it comes to mixed martial arts training, testosterone replacement therapy. For
it's
folks
magic.
Who are, yeah, for folks who don't know this debate, they're not mixed martial arts fans. And there's probably a lot of people listening to this that aren't. For a long time, over a year, 2 years, whatever it was, you were allowed to get prescribed testosterone. And Brennan Schaub said it best. We were discussing it on the podcast. He said that there's youth. And with youth, you have elevated hormone levels, but you have a lack of experience. You have a lack of knowledge. And then as you get older, you get wiser, you get smarter, you have more knowledge, but the body just does not respond the way it used to. And Eve Edwards was talking to him, and he was saying, you know, man, I'm, you know, he's like 37 now. He's like, I know so much now, but my body just doesn't listen. Just doesn't do what it did when I was 20 and I didn't know as much. And
love
that this is the nature. I love Eve. Yeah. He's a great guy. But there's that nature balance that is sort of stopped and it's placed with injections of testosterone. And then you're introducing this weird element into one of the most dangerous sports competitions the world has ever known. Mixed martial arts. One of the most, there's more on the line as far as your emotions, your physical body is at risk. There's always, and you're changing nature. You're making it so that these old wise people now are juiced to the gills and they can train 17 hours a fucking day. And it gets real weird.
Yeah.
It gets real weird when that's, for a while, was accepted by athletic commissions.
Yeah, the youth is wasted on the young. You know, like that expression is like you have now, you know, like I'm 34. I've been doing martial arts for forever. I want the body of a 22-year-old with what I know now.
Right.
You know, but I can chemically do that, you know, through testosterone, which is what guys have been able to do for the past couple of years. And it's dangerous, you know, like if it was golf, I wouldn't care. You know, if it's baseball and like Sammy Sosa, Mark McGwire era, I don't really care.
Right.
But we're in a sport where we're hitting each other in the face and choking each other unconscious. We do not need the advantage of taking the years of experience of doing martial arts for, you know, 20 some odd years and then giving us bodies of 20-year-olds. The physicality, the recovery, the responsiveness. It's horrible, you know, but guys have been doing it. And now we're at this juncture where we're now saying, okay, it's not okay. Like, you can't have an athletic commission allow you to do it. So does that mean that guys are going to do it on the side and do it orally so they don't, because they know when they're going to get tested, or
mm-hmm.
now they're not being monitored, so they're just going to do it whenever and however they want? Like, what does that mean? It's scary.
It's weird because there were a few guys that were on it for several years and they were being very successful while they were on it, and then all of a sudden it gets pulled away.
Yeah.
So what do they do? Do they try to bring their body up to natural levels?
See, but that takes time.
It takes a long time.
Yeah, for like a, I don't know, let's say a hypothetical 37-year-old that's been on testosterone for 4 or 5 years and then he can't have it anymore, it's going to take that guy a long time, if ever, to be able to naturally produce testosterone.
And he'll never have the levels that he had when he was on
it.
No. Because the levels he's had when he was on it were 25-year-old's levels.
Yeah.
And the other thing is the things that you can take to bring your levels back up are also banned. Things like Clomid and all these different estrogen-producing or estrogen-suppressing devices. All these different chemicals that people do post-steroid cycle are also illegal.
Yeah.
So it becomes like that was what Dennis Seaver got popped for. He got popped for one of these post-steroid cycle things, and now he's on the shelf for 9 months because of this.
Yeah, people are like, wait, why was that guy – he failed a drug test because he's blocking estrogen?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you have to, or otherwise you're going to grow breasts after you've been using anabolic steroids and testosterone. It's like you have to.
Yeah, when you – well, see, there's testosterone replacement. Like if you went to a doctor and you said, you know, hey, doc, I'm 60 years old. I would like to get on some testosterone and have a better quality of life. Well, the doctor will give you a slow dose of testosterone, slowly ramp you up. He's not going to, bam, jack you and turn you into a 20-year-old. But what a lot of fighters are doing is they're taking way more than you would have when you were 20. And what happens is your body goes, what the fuck is going on? And it grows tits. Literally, your body starts producing massive amounts of estrogen to counteract the massive amounts of testosterone. Your body gets so confused as to these levels of hormones that are completely supernatural in your body. And under those conditions, you develop bitch tits.
Yeah.
And a lot of guys have had them. And you'll see this weird, like, thing that you see this jelly like growing around their nipples, and I've seen guys where they bounce up and down in the cage and they have tits.
Wait, it's remarkable to me where people don't understand, like, we're a pugilistic sport. Like, guys are trying to take every advantage, every shortcut that they possibly can. You know, like, you and I can look at a dude and we, like, just from the texture of his skin can now, like, if he's on a cycle, if he's off a cycle, if he was on a cycle, you know, like,
by texture of their skin, you mean like zits on their back,
like acne
and stuff like that,
or acne scarring, or
it's possible that they have that naturally.
It's
right?
Possible,
some guys,
you know,
but it is a sign,
you know, and then they have bitch tits,
mm-hmm.
you know, another sign, another clue, you know, or like a guy looked one way 5 years ago when he was 32, and now he's 37, and he looks then 10,000 times better than he ever has in his whole entire life.
You talking about Vitor Belfort?
No, I'm just giving you an example of perhaps another clue.
Okay.
You know, like, yes, I am. Just so we're not being unclear about
this.
Can
you talk about what we were talking about before the show, or is that the offer?
No.
No, okay.
So, you know, he's the scapegoat, I think, a little bit for TRT, because it was a bigger problem for the, you know, for the entire sport, where he, in my opinion, just personified a problem. And then, you know, everybody like pinned everything on him. But it was a big problem throughout the whole entire sports, which is performance-enhancing drugs. And is it right for a 37-year-old dude like Vitor Belfort to be on testosterone for 5 years, look amazing and fantastic while he's on it, and nothing like he did 5 years ago where, you know, he was struggling, you know, like winning a fight, losing a fight. Now he's like knocking guys out with crazy fight of the night, fight of the year, like knockout of the night, knockout of the year type stuff. You know, you can't have that turnaround and then like stop testosterone and 2 months later he's ready to go. No, that's chemical. You know, like, that doesn't work that way.
Yeah. How does a guy get off of it in that short of a time and then have the ability to compete again? It would seem like it would take like a year to get
if ever. Yeah. Chemically.
There's no way around it.
No, I'm not a doctor, you know, but having been a professional athlete for 13 years, I've never seen somebody that was so responsive, you know, to testosterone like he was, and then come clean and try to be an athlete like they were when they were using performance enhancing drugs afterwards, and just miraculously being as good as they were when they're on it. Never happened. I can't think of a, like, a single sportsman in history where they got popped, they were watched closely, and then performed as well after that point, you know, ever.
Yeah, I completely agree with you that it's so different than baseball and all these other things. What I don't like about the baseball steroid controversy is that a young kid who's coming up who wants to play baseball almost has to do it in order to compete. So yeah. When there's a guy like Mark McGwire who's juiced to the gills, crushing the ball out of the stadium, a young guy coming up that wants to be like Mark McGwire, most likely, unless you have incredible genetics, you're just a genetic specimen, just a weird freak of nature, some guy who's just the extreme mesomorph, you're probably not going to ever be able to do that.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, that to me sucks, that a young guy has to risk his endocrine system and put it in it. But there's such a big difference between that and a combat sport.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what the solution is.
It's testing.
Testing, right?
Year-round testing, random testing, in-fight camp, post-fight. You know, like right now, fought 2 weeks ago. I'm getting back into training 2-3 times a day. Like this is when a guy
test him.
Yeah. You know, like,
and just show up. Hi.
Yeah. Joe Silva's about to throw an offer, you know, my way, let's say to fight in 10 weeks. He knows he's going to throw an offer my way. Before he throws the offer my way, a guy from the athletic commission in the respective state that I'm going to be fighting in shows up and says, "Hey, pee in the cup." That's how you're going to get a fair, equal system, you know, not where you tell a guy in Brazil, "Hey, you need to come up here and take a drug test." And he's like, "Oh yeah, man, I'll be there in like 4 days."
Yeah.
You know, no, dude, like athletic commission guy shows up randomly and right there, pee in the cup.
And when you catch someone, it can't. I think it should be more than 9 months. And, you know, I think in this day and age, you should let everybody know, hey, look, we're going to cut you. You're not going to fight for this organization anymore. And let them know. And then just say, this is the rule. This is where we're at right now. Yeah. So everyone's been served notice. Everyone knows what the repercussions are of this illegal activity that puts people in jeopardy. My real concern is, medical science is not going to stop. Medical science and the innovative, yeah, the technology
that are
constantly, not just cheat, but just the things that they're going to come up with to change the human body, just restorative capabilities of new advancements and new techniques. Like, you could say that, like, getting in that cryo chamber, if you can do that cryo chamber and another guy can't do that cryo chamber, do you have an advantage? Is it an unfair advantage? You know, where do you draw the line? Should you be able to take creatine? Well, creatine's legal. Doesn't that increase muscle power? And it does. It increases your ability to work harder. It's like, where is the line? Can you take Tribulus? Can you take, you know, on its T+? We're having great results with that T+ stuff where guys are showing these 50% increases in rates of lifting and their rate of progress over people that are not taking it, and double-blind placebos. Like, when does it become legal and when does it become cheating? When is it like a nice supplement and when is it a performance-enhancing drug?
Yeah, I think one of the big things is, what does it do to your body in the long run?
Right.
You know, when you're using a supplement, we'll just call them all supplements. We'll just even remove performance-enhancing drugs from the discussion. Just a supplement that does, in the short term, great benefits. In the long term, big damage. You know, when you have WWE stars that are dying at 41 from heart attacks, you know, and lo and behold, they've been doing steroids for 12 years. You know, it's tragic, it's sad, but not surprising.
Isn't a lot of those guys, it's pain pills?
Yeah.
Those guys are folks who don't respect pro wrestlers. You know, I know a lot of people think that, oh, it's all fake, it's silly. Those guys work hard. That
is damage their bodies
all the time. Yeah. If you watch those guys flying through the air and jumping on each other, that's not a free ride.
Yeah.
They're getting hurt all the time. And a huge problem in that world is guys that get hooked on pain pills, man. Yep.
Well, they damage their body, you know, but then they have a show next Saturday. You know, they have to, like, you know, McMahon's like, "No, you got to perform, bro. That's like you're on contract. You're going to get paid." They're like, "I can't move my hands right now. You know, like, I can't use my fingers." Like, all right, well, take this. You know, now everything doesn't hurt and you'll be able to perform, because that's what's important.
Yeah, it becomes like a thing where there's things that you can take that elevate your body's natural production of testosterone, and they can enhance your body's production. But what they don't do is introduce synthetic versions of it that shut down your endocrine system. Yeah. What they don't do is give you these hyperhuman levels that are causing you to grow tits. You know, there's got to be like a comfortable medium between eating healthy, having benefits like the cryo chamber and all these different things that do enhance recovery, but don't put you and your body in danger. Don't burn you out in the short term, you know, to give you like the rest of your life. You're fucked. You know, from 35 on, your body's just devastated.
It's not going to be black and white. You know, it's not going to be a line drawn in the sand. You know, that line needs to be able to be moved. You know, it needs to have, you know, commissions and medical professionals that can adjust and adapt to what's happening, you know, with the growth of science. You know, like, there's a reason why we're breaking records at every Olympics. We're getting better.
Yeah.
You know, like, with the human body, how to make it perform better. Having people that are smarter than me, like, figure out where those lines are and move them, you know, so that you don't have to, but that line has to be there, you know. It can be a mobile line that they move, you know, from year to year, but that line has to be there. And when guys step across it, you know, there has to be repercussions.
My concern is what's really going to happen in the future, which happens with almost anything that involves human innovation. Like, if you look back at the cell phones of the 1990s, where they had these fucking giant bricks and they'd hold them up to the head and rap videos. Now you can go anywhere in the world, in a third world country, in an impoverished neighborhood, and people have these really small, incredibly complex cell phones that are just these magical devices that allow you to interface with the entire knowledge base of the world. And they're everywhere. I wonder what's going to happen when you have the kind of technology that they're working on right now, genetic engineering at a cellular level, where they're able to change people. I mean, I'm sure you're aware of the myostatin inhibitors, like these things that they use with they've demonstrated in whippets, these dogs, where just because of breeding, just a mistake in breeding, they've produced these super hypermuscular dogs that have double the muscle, and cows as well. Have you ever seen those images?
Yeah.
It's incredible, right? Well, people are being born, just born with it. A kid in Germany was born just a genetic mistake or a benefit to him. Well, they're going to be able to figure that out with a pill or with a shot. And your fucking mailman's going to have it. Your mailman's going to look like the Hulk.
Yeah.
And when that happens, when it's everywhere, what do we do with athletes?
You know, the Germans were trying it with eugenetics. You know, like, we've done it periodically throughout history. The Spartans did it. You know, they did it at a
What did the Spartans do?
They'd throw babies that didn't meet their requirements off the cliff. Yeah. There's eugenetics at a very primal level. It happens in nature all the time, where a mom will be like, this cub is not going to be able to walk. I'm leaving it.
Yeah.
You know, so, like, that's eugenetics. That's survival of the fittest. Now, we as super too smart for our own good sometimes, humans can take eugenetics and fix it with chemistry. That's scary, you know, where we can just like magically pop out like superhuman. I don't know if I'm ready for that.
I don't know if anyone's ready for
it. Or the implications of what that means morally.
If we don't get hit by an asteroid or invaded by aliens or blow each other up with nukes, it's coming.
Yeah.
They're not going to stop. There's eggheads that are in laboratories right now that are constantly working on new shit. And that's what they do. And that's what humans do. We push the boundaries of innovation. We always have. It's part of what makes us human. It's why we're on a podcast right now talking to a microphone that neither you nor I could have ever figured out on our own. It's just a part of the program. And they're going to figure out something, man. They're going to inject you with nanobots or some sort of a new chemical that allows your body to work like Spider-Man. I mean, you're going to fucking climb walls. You're gonna have incredible balance. They're going to figure out a way to stop traumatic brain injury by re-engineering the human mind. There's going to be a lot of crazy shit. It might not be in our lifetimes, but our children's children, for sure, are going to experience human beings that no one has ever experienced in the entire history of the world itself.
Yeah, it's coming.
It's coming by human innovation. Yep. It's going to leapfrog evolution.
I'm not sure I want to, like, I'm going to kind of sad that I'm going to miss it, maybe. You know, because, like, I want to reap the benefits of it. But then at the flip side, you know, like, I don't want to have to deal with the implications of that.
I'm sad that I'm going to miss it too, or we might not miss it. We might just catch the wave. But I'm glad that I saw the world before a lot of shit was there. Like, my kids are going to grow up in a world. I have a 17-year-old, and she doesn't have any idea what life was like before the internet. Yeah. She has no idea. The internet's always been there. If she has a question, oh, there's the answer. I grew up, I was retarded when I was her age, and I put it in her head every day. I go, let me tell you, if you met me, if I was 17 and you were 17, you would think, oh my God, this is the dumbest fucking guy that's ever walked the face of the earth, and he thinks he's so smart. Yeah. I was an idiot. I knew how to throw kicks, and I knew which Stephen King books I liked. That's it. I knew the right combination of words to say to get a girl to fuck me. Sometimes, that's it. Yeah. That's all I knew. I was a moron. Like, what a 17-year-old knows today, as opposed to what they knew when I was. Now, the future is going to be even crazier than that, but at least I got a perspective. I got to see what it was like to grow up where you didn't know. If you called someone and they weren't home, they just weren't fucking home. Yeah. You know, I remember when answer machines were invented, where people were like, holy shit.
You get on the internet and you'd hear this.
And it was slow as fuck. And if you wanted to see a picture or something, it would be like click, 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 click.
And maybe it was click, click, black, click, white, and green.
Yeah. Know,
or variations of those three.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I remember when internet searches first came about, too. When you would first find, I got a great story. There was, we don't even need to say the name of the organization, but a buddy of mine used to be co-owner of a small mixed martial arts organization. And this was in the late 90s, and they were just starting to promote fighters through the internet. And they were just starting to do bios where they would research a guy through the internet. Well, they researched this guy, and they find out that a guy with the exact same name won something called the Hungriest Butt Contest.
Oh, no.
So their gladiator, their heavyweight, their Adonis, 6'4", shredded man with his penthouse pet girlfriend, you know, that he would parade around at all these events, also had done gay porn.
Yeah.
And so they pull down the picture. They download some pictures. And my friend described it as like, you see click, click, click. Click, oh, no. Click, click. You know how those yeah. pictures would slowly show up on a 56K modem? It would, like, you would get the top of it, and it would slowly start to pan down. And as it pans down, well, that looks like his hair. Click, click, click. That looks like it could be his forehead. Click, click. Well, that's his eyes. Yeah. Click, click, click. That's a dick in his mouth. Oh, my God. And there's a dick in his ass. Oh, my God. And there's two guys using him like Chinese finger handcuffs. And they're like, whoa. And so this dude had no idea that that was even possible to internet. He'd use the same name.
Yeah.
You know, he just figured, no one's going to look that up but homos, you know?
And then they did.
Yeah. Well, they also said, you know, he needed a lot of money, and they gave him some money. So he did it once. Turned out he did like 100 films. You know, it was a lot.
Was
he did
the money
a lot.
Good?
How good could it be? The joke is, I would say, you know, if what does a lot of money mean to you? A lot of money to me means I do one gay porno and I live like in a Jay-Z video for the rest of my life. You know, I'm in my underwear with two bottles of Cristal on a yacht with 1,000 models forever. That's, if he did 100 porns, he should have all the money on the planet by my calculations.
Yeah, there's no one richer ever anywhere.
Fucking his con. Fuck everyone who's ever lived who's got money. That guy would have all the money. Every country would be bankrupt, and this guy's bank account would have all the cash.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the thing is, it's just like no one knew before that an internet search was a possibility. And think about how many people that have done things that just had no idea. Well, you're going to be able to find that out? Mm. Like, how could you? And find it out on your phone. Just
yep. And be able to access the person that said content is about.
Yeah.
Like, never in our history, in mankind's existence, have we been able to connect so effortlessly to so many different people?
Yeah.
You know, like a fan that doesn't like me, you know, can just get on Twitter and like tell me that I'm a baby killer, like just because, you know, or they can do anything, anytime, anywhere, and they, you know, like you can find out anything about anybody and then probably reach that person.
Especially a fighter or someone who's got a social media account or a presence.
Who doesn't have a social media account? You know, like
there's a few folks that I know that just avoid it all together, but they don't have to do it.
Yeah, if there are 350 million people here, like almost all of them, like 300
and Mexicans. Got to count Mexicans. It's probably another
50 million
at least. I don't. Who knows how many? It's not. I love Mexicans. Don't get me wrong, but there's a lot of them that aren't taking the census. How often do you get fucked with on social media?
Oh, all the time.
All the time.
Yeah. I guess I'm like a polarizing figure. I don't know how. I think I'm kind of a likable guy, but for some reason
people have just a problem with strength. Huh. People have a problem with confidence. People have a problem with folks that have strong opinions or controversial opinions. And instead,
a lot of those.
Well, you know, you should. I think anybody who's paying attention to the world and sees all the contradictory information that we're receiving, sees the chaos, sees how fucked our political system is, our financial system. If you don't have strong opinions, if you don't have controversial opinions, you're not paying attention.
No. Open your eyes.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I can't tell you how many just conversations I've had about gun control, just about guns itself. I'm like, goddamn, guns aren't the problem. It's people that use guns that are the problem. You leave a gun, you know, that old adage, guns don't kill people, people kill people. And people will fucking argue that to the end of time. God damn it, it's true. Every time you go to the gas station, you got a store in that gas station that sells lighters. You got fluid that comes out of a pump. And anyone can just light people on fire. I mean, anyone can do it. It hasn't happened that often, but anyone can do it.
Or just take your car and turn 2 degrees to the right and run down the sidewalk.
Yeah.
The option to kill is always there.
It's always there.
It's the choice. You know, and they're like, but it's a tool. It's a mechanism that serves no other purpose. You know, a car can get you from point A to point B. So why do they need a gun if the only thing it does is kill? You know, like, I could say the same thing about a tractor if I wanted to. You know, like, if I wanted to make a killer tractor, the only thing that it's designed for is to kill because I put spikes on its wheels, you know, and it's not doesn't excavate anything besides human souls.
Yeah.
But no, it's the choice to kill. You know, it's like, get over it. People kill.
It is a way that they can do it easily, and that is an issue. But it's also, why does a person have the ability to do that? And how come so little effort and so little emphasis is on what causes a person to be able to disconnect or to be able to have so much hate and anger in their heart that they can kill a bunch of school children, that they can use a gun to shoot up a mall? Like, why isn't that the subject of discussion? And why is it always the tool for madness? Yeah. It's not the madness itself.
No.
It's the tool of madness. But that same tool could be used by anyone else to do a million other things. It's like, it's a bad analogy, but it's one that I always use with marijuana. People go, oh, you could ruin your life if you smoke pot. But you could also take a hammer and hit yourself in the dick. You know, should we make hammers illegal? Because a hammer's just a tool. If you take marijuana and just enjoy it and you don't hurt anybody, should that person be penalized because someone decided to just wake and bake every day and then fucking go into debt and wind up? It's humans are the problem.
Yeah.
And human weakness and a lack of character and all sorts of chemical imbalances.
Or the culture and the structure around the person that led them to subsequently make these horrific decisions and actions, you know, that they use whatever tool, don't care what it is, gun, knife, everything up to that point is what we should, the emphasis of trying to understand or prevent and acknowledge and research should be done, not take away, you know, whatever it was that was the end conclusion. It's all the things up to that point that are important that nobody pays attention to, nobody cares about.
But that's what's ridiculous about
stupid.
Any sort of control, gun control, knife control, bow and arrow control debate. It's not that. It's what constitutes what makes a human being capable of horrific things. And I think you're uniquely qualified for a bunch of reasons. One, because you have a family. You know what it's like to raise a person. And two, you've seen the consequences of human beings when they're in this environment that is totally fucked from the jump. And you see these religious fanatics and you see fundamentalism, you see chaos and a land that's just overrun with it. You see it's humans. It's the development of humans.
In error. Use the development erroneously, like the development of a human the wrong way.
Yes.
Like, there's the right way, and there's not there's the right way. There's about a billion right ways.
Yeah.
And then there's a couple of wrong ways, you know, and the couple of wrong ways end up with bad products.
And it's, again, this is a sort of contradictory thing that through combat and through, you know, especially through martial arts, I think the deepest bond of commitment that I've ever experienced outside of my family is the friends that I've trained with and people that I've competed with that have just, you see them, you know who the fuck they are. When you see a guy break in training, when you see a guy, you know, with 30 seconds to go in the round, put his hands down on his knees and just take deep breaths and step away. And then you see the coach go, get back in there. Yeah. And you see him suck it up. And, you know, there's the guys who suck it up and there's the guys who don't. And you see the difference. You see who they are. You see their soul. You see, and you learn about people that way in a way that a lot of folks don't ever get a chance to learn even about themselves.
The refiner fire, the refiner's fire is like this beautiful thing. You know, it's
the what? Say that again.
Refiner's fire.
Refiner's fire.
Yeah, it's like you take a metal.
Refineries.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Like when you're making a sword, you know, the folding process of heating it up and pounding out the impurities and folding it again and pounding out the impurities. Like the hotter the fire, the more bad stuff gets cooked out. That's the same with people. You know, you put them in a room that's hot. Put them in a gi that's hot, around a whole bunch of other dudes that are like trying to choke each other out and kill you. You get glimpses of the depth and hardness of somebody's character and soul. And it's these awesome snapshots. And even kids, like down at the youngest level, putting them into competitions of martial arts, you see the exact same thing. You see the development of this character and of somebody's soul as they get tougher and deeper, you know, as a human. And you get in these snapshots, you get a clear glimpse of who that person is. What's part of them? You're like, it's gorgeous.
Cron Gracie said it best. He said, I reserve judgment until I've trained with you.
Yeah.
You know, he said, I think, you know, me, you know, you seem like a nice guy, but I reserve judgment until I've trained with you,
yeah.
Which is such a great way to put it. And, you know, a lot of people think, well, I don't want to fucking train you. You don't have to. It's not that. It's just you should in your life do something difficult. If it is not martial arts, maybe it's mountain climbing. Maybe it's hiking. Maybe
mud
it's
runs.
Anything.
It doesn't matter.
Do something that's hard to do. Maybe it's write a book. Find out what your fucking barriers are. Because the most reprehensible thing, the thing that we all pretty much universally despise, is a spoiled rich kid. Mm. A spoiled kid that never had to work for anything. They were handed it their whole life. Their parents never gave them values. And what'd they do? They grew up yelling at servants, and then they become some rich asshole that's a sociopath. I mean, that is that's a key character in so many movies, that's in so many books, literature. We all can relate to that person who didn't earn it, who got that place without hard work, and how gross they are.
I hate that pussy.
Damn, fucking everybody does. You're supposed to. It's supposed to. They're not supposed to be there. It's not supposed to happen. You're not supposed to win the lottery like that. That fucks you up.
But the really remarkable ones that are the ones that could or have access to all of that and then choose not to, or on the total flip side, the guys that have access to none of that and challenge themselves and put themselves through hardships, the Aldos, you know, that like they have nothing and just through hard work, determination, they become something, you know, like those are two complete polar opposites of a human that I'm just like, I adore, you know, like guys that, you know, in the military, you see these guys like, you're like this Ivy League, super rich, you're enlisted.
Yeah.
Why are you here? You know, you could have done anything. They're like, I wanted to be here. Like, I love you. You're amazing. You know, and then the flip side, you know, the Puerto Rican that his parents swam over here or are on some horrible boat. And, you know, like they're one generation removed and they've like, they put themselves through college or maybe they like join the military so they could go to college and they're at this exact same point of their life as this rich yuppie guy that are just there because they want to see how hard they can, or how far they can push themselves.
Yeah. Human beings are just, we are just a mass of potential, and it's awesome to see someone rise through adversity and reach a potential that elevates us all. Because when you see someone reach their potential or reach a very high level of anything, it changes the way you look at what's possible. When you see a guy who gets up at 6 o'clock in the morning, the alarm clock goes off, and he just fucking hits those hills and starts running, and he does it every morning before work, you go, fuck, I'm a bitch. I'm just a weak bitch. I don't do that. Fuck. And then it changes your perspective. You want to do that too. You want to absorb a little bit of that guy's strength and that feeling that you get from being around that guy. It's empowering. Or you're one of those guys that diminishes that and tries to squash it because you're insecure and you wanna tweet Tim Kennedy, you fucking bitch, and fuck you and fuck the military, man. You know, there's folks like that too. I think that strength is the best antidote for a lot of the weaknesses that we find in our society that we consider to be strength, like bullies. People say, like, what's the best solution to bullies? Teach them how to fight. Teach them all how to fight. Everyone. I think that is a core problem with men. Men have a giant fear hanging over their head all day long, and that is being dominated by other men. Yeah. You know, I mean, this is what led me to martial arts 100% was I was scared of dudes kicking my ass. So I got into martial arts as a very young kid because of that. And I think that the more kids, if we had programs in school where we taught martial arts to kids in class, you would have so few instances of bullying. I think the dramatic decrease in bullying and the respect that people have for each other would change. The respect that people have for themselves. Like, a bully cannot respect themselves. They just can't. Unless there's some sort of a complete sociopath, you're not going to be happy with yourself if you pick on someone smaller than you. You're doing it because you're insecure. But if you weren't insecure, or you were less insecure, or you had some sort of sense of personal sovereignty because of training, you would have less of this inclination to do something shitty to someone like that.
Yeah, it'd be cool to see.
Fuck yeah, man. I think martial arts programs should be mandatory in school. Just like they have PEs mandatory for boys, especially martial arts should be mandatory.
Yeah, you want to see your kid have discipline, focus, understanding of right and wrong, mm-hmm. A little bit of confidence, restraint. Put them in martial arts. You know, yeah. You did it so you didn't get beat up. I did it because I was second born. I was a crazy middle kid. You know, my dad's like, at a very early age, like, you are going to be doing martial arts, you know? And so, like, I was like 9, and I remember saying a bad word on the mat and having, you know, my sensei come up with an eskrima stick and hit me in the back of the head. You know, like, I messed up and doing something. He's like, and then I said a bad word when I messed up, and then pow! You know, like, I didn't say that bad word again. But more importantly, I was able to control myself, which was the necessary element that I needed.
And also the great feeling of accomplishment that you get when you learn that you can control yourself.
Yeah.
When you feel yourself improving, you feel your character improving, and you have a difficult situation and you navigate it successfully, and you go, oh, I'm a better person now than I was when I was whatever, when I was young and stupid. And that's just one of those things where everybody wants to be comfortable. Everybody wants to look towards their golden age, and everybody wants to retire and sit on the couch and put your feet up. That's horseshit. That's not you only can experience that and enjoy it if you've earned it. And no one wants to earn it. The earning it is the most important part of your life.
Individual responsibility. Nobody has it. You got to earn it. You got to work for it. You got to, you know. And well, it's so much better when you do.
Yes. Well, that's why I think guys like you are important, man. I think you set a great example in that. I think you set a great example with your words. I think you set a great example with your actions. And it's one of the reasons why I've been wanting to talk to you on the podcast. You're a very inspirational guy, in my opinion. I think the way you talk about things and the way you express yourself, it's admirable, and I think it helps people. It sets a very high standard. And I think setting a high standard is one of the key things that young men and young women as well need in life. They need to see a high standard.
I'm not perfect. You know, like, I make mistakes probably way too much or more often than I'd like to admit. But, like, I'm always searching and seeking to get better. You know, like, and I think that's something that I always try to project. You know, and the only way to get there is like you've just said, it's through hard work. It's through determination. It's, you know, it's through the amazing innate part of the human being, which is the ability to do, you know, and to not quit and to have the inner strength to try to achieve and surpass whatever it was before.
And there's beauty in imperfection. Mm-hmm. You know, this idea that you're going to be this enlightened Kwai Chang Kang character, like in the TV show. You got to take a leak? Go ahead, head on. I saw you drinking that gigantic smart water. There's dudes who have bladders like mine who could just power through a 3-hour podcast. And then there's guys like Tim Kennedy. You know, it's cool. It's like, you know, we all learn. We show. We show that there's higher levels. My fucking bladder, bro. It's like a duffel bag that you can carry guns in. It's large and it's durable and it gets dirty and filled with liquid. But don't worry about it. I can hang in there. What I was saying to Tim that's important is it's, I think everybody has this idea that there's some guy out there that's like Jet Li, that's like a perfect person, some character. There's the beauty really is in the imperfection. The beauty is in knowing that we're all just these weird, flawed creatures that are trying to figure out. It's not even that we're flawed. It's just that we're dealing with an impossible amount of variables that we're constantly navigating. And this idea that you should have gotten it right, it's not what it is. It's the idea is that you learn from what you get wrong, and then that thing you don't do the same way next time. You say, you know what, I made a mistake the last time I was in a similar situation. Now I know that, and so now I'm going to power through with the knowledge that I've accumulated in my life from my past mistakes. That's a huge factor about being a person. A huge factor is that we're all learning from each other. And I said a lot of cool shit when you were gone. But learning and learning from each other is the whole reason why it's great to have inspirational people to draw from. And I think that now there's never been a time like this where you could just go on YouTube and you could be inspired for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You could watch videos of guys pushing through things. Guys are doing fucking 100-mile ultra marathons, and just seeing people talk about the things that inspire them and what pushes them. There's never been a time like this where inspiration is available everywhere you look.
In a whole bunch of different, like, not everybody's inspired the same way. You know, like, I think it's amazing to see a guy that has nothing do something remarkable. To come, you know, not the underdog, but that has no resources. That then all, you know, like, there's this guy in Austin, Texas. He runs this running group called the Gilbert Gazelles. And the Hutu, when the genocide was occurring, he has these burns on his body because his family was murdered and he was piled into this pile of bodies and set on fire. And once the militias left from the Hutu and Tutus, he got up and started running. Then he went to the NCAA and started running there. And then he went to the Olympics. And now he runs. He's an inspirational dude in Austin that just tells people to run. And he's one of the most remarkable human beings. And there's tons of people out there that are so amazing and remarkable. And you can, if you just look, you can find them. And then I love latching on to people like that and just trying to get into what's in there and try to, not, I don't want to say steal it, but I want some of that.
Yeah. You don't steal it because they still have it.
Oh, they'll always have it.
But yeah, but you absorb some of it.
Yeah.
It's very important. We surround ourselves with inspirational people and we become inspired. Surround yourself with negative cunts and your life is going to be a wreck.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of people don't realize that, and they just try to work through these negative cunts in their life. You got to cut them off, man. You got to cut them off and keep moving because they will hold you back. There are crabs in that bucket, and when you try to reach the top of that bucket, they will latch a hold of your little crab legs and drag you down with them.
My dad was so, you know, retrospectively, my dad was so wise when he's like, no, you don't want those guys around you. You know, you're going to be who you surround yourself with. You know, and I was like, whatever, that guy is so cool. I want to hang with that guy, you know? And now I'm like, God dang it.
It's hard.
How did he know so early?
There's always going to be people that will, but those people are also important because you learn, you know, you learn from watching them fuck their lives up. I've never done cocaine. And one of the reasons why I never did cocaine is because I grew up with a buddy of mine whose cousin was selling cocaine. And I watched this guy fall apart. Him and his girlfriend would just do blow, and they would hide out in their place, and they had this attic apartment, and they would just fucking watch TV all day, and they would shrink. Like, their fucking face was shrinking, their body was shrinking. All they would do was do coke. I don't even know if they ate. You know, and I watched this guy. It was like a guy who got bit by a vampire and became, like, this diseased thing. And I went, whoa, keep the fuck away from coke, you know? And I didn't have to do coke and go to rehab and pull myself out. I lived 40-plus years of my life with no desire to do coke. Fuck that.
Yeah.
And so it's not always good. You need losers. You know, losers are there too for a reason. It's that the whole world was filled with inspirational winners. Like, how would you figure out where do we begin if everybody's a fucking winner? Yeah. No, you got to see people who ring that bell, right? You got to see people who tap out quick. You got to see a guy who taps before the choke is even sunk in. Like, what are you doing?
Or taps to strikes.
Well, you know, sometimes, you know, GSP versus Matt Serra, sometimes it's good to tap the strikes because the fucking fight's over. Yeah. You know?
You're not going anywhere.
When the guy's top of you dropping bombs and you're starting to see sparks and the elevator doors closing, do you think tapping the strikes is a bad idea?
I don't know if I have it in me.
Ah!
I don't know. Like,
right.
I'm not saying it's a bad idea. Maybe I should respect the guy that's smarter than I am. You know, like, I'm kind of like an oak. Mm-hmm. I'm big, I'm strong, and I'm dumb. You know, like, I'm going to grow, and I'm going to do what I do. Maybe I wish I was smart enough to tap to strikes. I don't think I am. I don't think I have it in me to be like, okay, I'm not going to get out of here. I'm just going to quit.
I don't think there's any problem with tapping to strikes, but I respect your viewpoint. I know what you're saying, and I think you probably have to have that sort of mentality to be an elite-level competitor in something like MMA, where that's not even an option in your head.
Yeah,
there's guys who don't tap. You know, look at fucking War Machine. He just gets choked out. There's a lot of guys that just say, I will never tap. I will go out. I'll get my arm broken. Fuck it. I'm not tapping. It's not in there.
Yeah, it's not.
Look at John Jones. We fought Vitor. His arm was completely hyperextended. Would Absolutely. Not tap. Let it get completely popped backwards, and then won the fight anyway.
Mm-hmm. Before you go to Special Forces Selection, there's this phase for guys off the street called SOPC, Special Operations Preparation Course. The only thing that is an attritor. They take like 400 dudes, and they end up sending 80 of them to selection. The other 320 at some point either got broke or quit. I remember seeing the gong that you go up and hit, and it's like so longingly looking at that thing, being like, that's the smart thing to do. Like, you know, you have blisters in your feet that you've injected stuff into so that you can't, so like your skin like glues back to what portion it separated itself from. You know, like you've lost 20 pounds in the course of 30 days. And you're looking at that gong and you're like, a smart person would go and hit that gong. You know, and I watched guys go up and do it, and I was like, that's a smart person, probably. I just didn't have it in me. So maybe I'm dumb. I think that's my take. I'm either like too dumb, you know, like there's a balance there, and I think we're kind of agreeing with each other from different perspectives.
Well, I think that you're being self-deprecating when you're calling yourself dumb. It's not a dumb thing, but if you wanted to be smart about the amount of punishment that you endure, yeah. But if you wanted to build the highest level of character and durability and mental toughness possible, then it would be dumb to hit that gong.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because the benefits of not hitting that gong is what you are today.
I would have got a cup of coffee and a hot breakfast.
But you didn't.
I
did
it.
Get a cup of coffee today and have the knowledge that you didn't hit that gong.
It's a good-looking gong. You know? I could go back. I might have.
You're a thick guy for 185 pounds. Like you're built in a very, you're very muscular.
Squat
for your weight class
is the word my wife uses.
What do you walk around at before you start your cut?
To like day of cut?
No, if you had a fight that was 4 months from now and you don't have to worry about your weight, what are you gonna weigh?
220.
220. Wow. And did you fight light heavyweight at all?
Yeah, I think I fought WC as heavyweight. IFL is a light heavyweight, middleweight, and then I've stayed at middleweight for a while.
So if you're walking around in the 200s, how do you navigate a weight cut to get down to 185 pounds? Because that is a big issue in MMA, is that point of diminishing returns where some guys, like Anthony Rumble Johnson, perfect example.
God, he's good at 205.
Jesus Christ. The kid was so fucking big in between fights. I would see him walking around. He was fighting at 170, fought Kevin Burns, and I saw him like 2 months later, he was 230. I go, what the fuck are you eating? He's a house. He was bigger than Fedor. I mean, he was on Inside MMA with Fedor, and he was towering over him.
Yeah.
Wider, thicker. You're like, what is going on? And then finally, he gets his shit together, decides to come back as a light heavyweight and dominates Phil Davis at 205. And you're like, okay, this kid like was obviously past the point of diminishing returns. He was diminishing his own ability to perform by cutting so much weight. What is that number?
It's, I think it's different for every athlete and person, you know? And, you know, when I'm 215, 220, I feel like I'm a juggernaut. I never have training related injuries. You know, like I'm running an extra 3-4% body fat. I'm just like all around healthier. My brain's working right. You know, like my libido is good. You know, I'm sleeping very soundly all 8 hours, you know, like everything's great. You know, like when I'm down to like that 195, 193 pre-cut type weight, you know, where I'm like that 5% body fat, my brain's not firing on all cylinders, you know, like it's libido's rough. You're training 3-4 times a day. Like just things suck. You know, like everything hurts.
You get down to 5% body fat when you're like 195.
Yeah.
How are you measuring it?
Pinch test water stuff, the water tanks and then the calipers.
That's a lot. That's really low.
Yeah. It is.
And then you're going to cut another 10 pounds on top
of that.
That's
just water.
Right. 10 pounds of water.
Yeah, I think my final cut's usually like 8 pounds of, but you know, my body doesn't, I don't think it even recognizes, you know, like I'll cut. I fought, Michael Bisping. I was probably 205 when I fought him. You know, I weighed in at 190 or 186 the day before, you know, and then 30 hours later, you know, I've been eating and drinking and feeling fantastic.
Do you IV? Do you recoup for that? How many bags do you use?
1500 milliliters to 2000 milliliters. Lactic ringer. I honestly don't know fighters that don't.
Right. And nowadays, pretty much everybody does, unless you're like a Frankie Edgar that literally weighs in at what he fights at.
Maybe he's like putting some weights in his pocket.
Yeah, Frankie fought at 155 and weighed 155. Lyoto Machida fought at 203 for the longest time and, you know, weighed in at 203 for a 205-pound weight class.
But look how good he is at 185.
Yeah, better, much better.
You know, so the diminished returns, like it's different for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm 5'11". You know, I have a 73-inch reach. There's no way that I can hang with the 205ers, mm-hmm. you know, that have 86-inch reaches,
right.
you know, that are 6'4". I might be as strong as they are, but I'm like as Brian Stan calls me, like a squat little hobbit, angry hobbit, sometimes troll. Endearingly, he refers to me as these things, but he's right, and I just can't reach him. You know, like John Jones runs around the cage, you know, and jabs me to death, and then when I try to, you know, like athletically explode in, then he violates me with something painful.
Yeah. Do you ever think about going 170? Is that possible?
Definitely possible.
Yeah?
Yeah. We've, honestly had Robbie Lawler beat Johnny Hendricks. I would cut to fight Robbie.
Really? Because you beat Robbie in Strikeforce.
Yeah.
Do you, you when you walk around at 205 or 220 rather, is it because you're lifting a lot of weights? Is it because you're doing a lot of,
Yes. I treat the annual cycle of like fight camp, post fight camp, pre fight camp, fight. And, kind of like, if you look at like an NFL player, you know, they have the preseason where they're trying to get their body strong and healthy so that when they go into, the season, they have everything that they need to perform during that season. So like my pre fight camp, like right now where I'm lifting a lot of weights, doing a high volume of work, where I'm working on, you know, like my sparring stuff now is a lot more drill oriented. I'm not burning tons of calories grappling or boxing or sparring, kickboxing. I'm lifting a lot of weights, so my body's responsively like getting healthy, big and strong again. I'm getting my technique better. So when I move into that fight camp, I have this mold of clay that's totally healthy that can be shaped into what needs to be shaped to be executed for a particular fight.
So when you think about like 220 and a guy like Rumble Johnson, who used to weigh somewhere around that, even heavier, and get down to 170.
It's crazy talk.
If you were going to get down to 170, if Robbie Lawler beat Johnny Hendricks, how would you do that? Would you cut out the weightlifting and start doing like marathon running? Like what would you do to get yourself leaner?
Yeah.
Would it be leaner or would it be like less muscle?
A little bit of both. You know, I'd definitely have to lose a little bit of muscle to be able to.
And how would you do that? By not lifting? Or
just changing the type of lifting that I'm doing. You know, like I'm not doing those 3-rep maxes of deadlift at, you know, 400 or 500 pounds.
Is that what you do these days?
Yeah. Like right now, yeah, absolutely. And I'm loving it. You know, it's like I did shrugs yesterday.
Just shrugs.
Well, not just shrugs, but like I got to do shrugs. You know, it's like I was asking my strength coach. I'm like, hey, can we do some curls? You know, and he's like, shut your mouth. You know, it's like like straps that you use on bars.
Right.
Like, I'm never allowed to touch those. And I was like looking at those, be like, how about I use some straps? That looks.
Yeah.
You can grab the bar and do some more weight. You know, he's like, no. Now you know, like the point of departure has come, and he's like, come back to me, Tim. And we're not doing curls. I'll let you do shrugs, but that's all. You know, like
so straps being you don't do straps because you only want to lift what your hands can hold up.
Yeah. What's the point?
Yeah, I don't ever use straps. Yeah. I see people using straps, and I get it. I get what
my
you're
ego
doing,
wants to use straps. Yeah.
Functionally, though,
no,
right? It should be whatever you could carry with your hands too. Especially for a grappler, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So you would just start doing like high reps, doing like
High volume, a lot more speed. You know, like I think I'd have to be faster too at 170. You know, like watching these guys, they're just like all over the place.
Mm-hmm. You see, like Damian Maya when he dropped down to 170, and you know fought Rick Story, and you see like the difference in the amount of physical strength that he had over a guy who was used to fighting at 170. It's a big leap.
Yeah.
Do you think there should be more weight classes?
Yeah,
I do too. Yeah, I think that like 185 to 205, Jesus fucking Christ, that's 20 pounds. Yep. There should be three champions in between those weight classes, or at least two.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at a guy from, I'll go all the way down from like 155 to 205. You know, you have 55, 70, 85. You have four weight classes from 155 to 205.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think it's crazy. And I think that, you know, a lot of people say that boxing is watered down by all the weight classes. I think it's watered down by all the titles, but I don't think there's anything wrong with having a welterweight class at 147 and then a junior middleweight at 154 and then a middleweight at 160.
Yeah.
The 6 pounds between 154 and 160 is fucking significant. 6 pounds is significant. 20 pounds is crazy. And I just think that there's just a lot of fighters who are tweeners, like Diego Sanchez.
Mm-hmm.
I think Diego should be fighting at 165. You know, I think when he gets to 155, I think he's too diminished. He's too scrawny. When he fights at 170,
he's a little soft.
He's a little small for some of those really big, giant dudes.
I think I'm kind of between 185 and 170.
Yeah.
Like my shape, you know, like my reach, my height. You know, like I would love there to be like a 180.
Yeah,
that'd
I
be
think
awesome for me.
There really should be more of that in the I mean, those are the things that I would like the UFC to change. The downward elbows, the knees on the ground, and more weight classes.
We've solved a lot of problems. Dana, can we go ahead and execute these things that Joe and I have concurred on from today's podcast?
Thank you. It's not even Dana. It's the athletic commissions. That's what's really crazy is that it's sanctioned by athletic commissions, and you really don't have that much influence over athletic commissions.
I mean, any.
Yeah. Especially, well, now that Keith Kaiser's gone, maybe they have a little bit more.
Yeah.
But I don't know how much they listen. I wish they would listen about a few things. Certainly downward elbows, and certainly at least consider revamping the scoring system and then adding weight classes.
Mm-hmm.
What other things about weight cutting do you find that are an issue? Like, there's obviously an issue with injuries, and there's obviously an issue with diminishing health. Do you worry about the long-term repercussions of, like, there was an article recently, Jim Miller was talking about weight cutting. He's like, I know I've taken years off my life through weight cutting. Do you worry about that?
I do. The things that, you know, I am really conscious about my brain. You know, when I'm cutting weight, I love reading. I love writing, you know, like even, you know, creative writing too. Like I love.
Do you write a blog? Do you keep a blog or anything?
Yeah, for me.
You know, just for you?
Yeah.
Are you going to publish it someday?
Maybe. There are a couple of times where I wrote some blogs when I was deployed, letters from a foreign land, and like people loved, like I'm an okay writer. I'm not the best. Like anyways, everybody's the worst critic. And when I'm cutting, like my brain doesn't work right. Like I feel it. And then when you're getting hit in the head while you're cutting, you know, from guys like John Jones and Carlos Condit, you know, like life sucks. Your brain sucks. So I'm like, yeah, I have, my eyes are wide open that there's, you know, physically going to be some repercussions to me fighting, you know, from me jumping out of airplanes for like, you know, at what point do I say, okay, I'm not going to do this because it hurts me in the long term. You know, like
you're 34.
Yeah.
Do you have a cutoff? Do you have like an age where you like, this is the age where I don't want to be doing this anymore.
Definitely.
What age is
I
that?
I can't tell you.
You can't tell me. No. Okay. But you have a number in your head where mm-hmm. you would like a goal to reach.
Yep. That. I love Randy Couture and Dan Henderson, and I think it's they had some of the greatest fights towards the end of their career. I am not going to be fighting at 40. You know, I'm not going to be fighting in my late 30s. You know, like,
oh, you told me the number then. That's only you don't leave it out 5 years. It's not much. Yeah, you got a 5 year window then. Wow.
Yeah, no way. I got too much I want to do.
What do you want to do?
I want to change people's lives. You know, I want to be able to impart individual responsibility to people. I want to save some animals. I want to hunt some more. I want to make some awesome TV shows and try
to. What kind of TV shows?
So Duck Dynasty. No, I do not want to do Duck Dynasty at all. And I don't even think I've ever seen a full episode. But
good those, for you.
Yeah, I haven't. Maybe I've seen like 3/4 of an episode. But
you done lost your redneck. I ain't lost my redneck.
Those guys took values that they wanted to project, and they figured out a conduit to do it. We might call them idiots, and like they have horrible accents, and they do stupid things, and but they had a set of morals that they try to convey, and they found an avenue to reach millions of people. You know, like I want that platform because I have some good things to say, you know, and I think I want to have an opportunity to make a difference.
Why don't you do a podcast? Start off with a podcast. Do a podcast now. Be like one of the first MMA guys. I mean, Brendan Schaub does one with Brian Callen, but yeah. Brendan's kind of a meathead, let's be honest. He's a great guy. I love him, but...
You're so like you're intimidating and smart. Like, how could I compete with the Joe Rogan?
The fuck out of here! Fuck out! Don't blow smoke up my ass, sir. I know what you're doing. I'm not that smart.
You are.
Nope.
I was warned. They're like, don't get in an argument with Joe because he doesn't forget anything and he's deceivingly smart. I was like, I'm aware of these things.
Well, I definitely look dumber than I am for sure, but that's not saying much because I look really fucking stupid.
I use that to my benefit as well.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm an infantryman. I'm a grunt. I'm an MMA fighter. I'm dumb.
Yeah.
Ahead, talk shit to me. Go ahead.
For sure. Yeah. I smoked a lot of weed. I've got plenty of brain damage going on. Absolutely. But I'm not nearly as dumb as I look. I look way fucking dumber. I think you would be great on a podcast. I think you, and the beautiful thing about a podcast is, and I fucking swear to God, everybody who comes on my podcast is like, you should have a podcast. I'm like trying to give, I don't know. I don't believe. It's not that I don't believe in competitions. I have the exact opposite of a famine mentality. I think there's 300 million fucking people out there. Everybody could support everybody, and there's still plenty to go around. You know, I really believe that.
But. Obviously, my bladder even can't handle the podcast of this length. So we've already discovered a limitation to.
Well, in your defense, you have a 1 liter smart water and you've drank a big cup of bulletproof coffee. There's a lot of liquids in there.
It was.
And it's also just stamina. I just, like, I probably couldn't keep up with your strength and conditioning program, and you can't keep up with my bladder program. My bladder is like a fucking, it's like a leather satchel back in the old days. They used to make them out of buffalo skins. Strong and durable, last a lifetime. Hand it down to your grandchildren. You could easily do a podcast, dude. And the beautiful thing about it is that no one would be able to tell you what to do.
Yeah.
No one would tell you what to say, what to talk about. You wouldn't have to converse with producers.
But can I captivate enough people to, you know, because I want that the access to the audience, you know, to influence lives. You know, would my words have enough meaning to draw in enough people?
Oh, of course they would.
I hope so.
They are doing that right now. Now, millions of people are going to listen to this.
If I jump out of an airplane, you know, into the water, you know, into the ocean with a whole bunch of sharks and go swim with them, like, people are going to tune into that.
But then what if you get eaten?
You know, I'll survive.
And then they're like, this whole thing is fucked now.
But then I get out of the water.
I'll survive, he says.
And I can talk to them. You know, it's like, 16 million people watched him parachute out of this plane into shark-infested waters.
Oh, you're out of your mind.
And then rode a motorcycle up onto the beach. You know, but then I have them.
But you have them already, man. You don't have to do that. Trust me, you don't have to do that. You've already done enough that you're qualified. You're a qualified, legit badass. The idea that you're going to parachute into sharks and that's going to change everybody. Well, the guy's a fucking pussy. Sharks? Oh, he's got me.
Yeah.
Let's sit down and listen to what Tim has to say. I think this just broke off here.
You are so powerful. No, Joe Rogan broke his microphone.
I think this just microphone with his... I'll just hold on to it till we're done.
Bare hands.
This microphone is made from in a foreign land where quality is not valued. You easily, dude, could do a podcast, easily, without a doubt. And I think that these, you do a lot of videos too with Ranger Up, right?
If you call them that.
I call them that. What was the one where you did the Black Swan thing?
That was interpretive dance.
Can we show that?
Yeah, that's fine.
Pull it up. What's the name of that?
I think it's Tim Kennedy Black Swan.
Pull up Tim Kennedy Black Swan.
Yeah, YouTube.
And I'll try to fix this microphone while that's happening.
Yes.
But the problem you're going to have with doing a television show is producers, because they're going to look at you and they're going to try to put you in a mold, and they're going to try to get you to do a bunch of fake shit. They do fake shit, man. They fake shit. I had a problem with fake shit on my sci-fi show. They faked a bunch of shit and I didn't find out about it until it was aired. And I came on the podcast and I apologized and I didn't know, and it was a huge fucking problem. And that was on a show called Joe Rogan Questions Everything. Like, I'm trying to find the truth about these things, and their instinct is still to fake shit and to put fake shit in that you don't even know about.
Well, that.
It's fucking horrible. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not very malleable. You're like,
No, you're not. That's why a podcast is perfect. You have a very unique vision, and your unique vision is qualified by your unique life experiences. Any Hollywood douchebag is not going to understand that, and they're going to try to mold you in what they think could be more profitable for the network.
Yeah, but they would also have to sleep at night, and they'd be scared of what I could do to them once they go to bed.
They would, but they wouldn't. They live in gated communities, and they fucking hire people to keep an eye out for you. Is this it? Here, play that, and I'll fix this thing.
Hello, and welcome to Masterpiece Theater. Here is a scene from Black Swan, performed by MMA fighter and Special Forces operator Tim Kennedy.
I had the craziest dream last night about a boy who was turned into a swan, but her queen falls for the wrong guy, and he kills himself.
For the folks who are not watching this, please watch this. Go to YouTube. What compelled you to do this?
So
the movie Black Swan, obviously.
Well, Natalie Portman is beautiful.
She is beautiful.
And my mom used to make us take dancing lessons. So there, as you can see, there's some skill here. You just can't do this stuff. Whatever, that is scary.
Your mom made you take dance, and your dad made you take martial arts.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Cooking classes with my mom.
Cooking classes?
Yep, hunting with my dad.
That makes a balanced person. That's like Miyamoto Musashi's Book of Five Rings. You know, he believed that every warrior should also be well-versed in poetry and calligraphy and art.
Yeah, it wasn't by choice. You know, I was like, yeah, let's go to ballroom dancing and learn how to swing dance.
Ballroom dancing?
Oh, yeah, she got them all.
Oh, God. Yeah. I mean, I'd have probably moved out.
I was like 11. I didn't have a choice.
Yeah, I would have found someone to take
me. The motivation was having fun. You know, like you can't – if you don't enjoy and have fun in life and be able to laugh at yourself and put on like a tutu – and dance around, you know, like a beautiful fairy, butterfly, swan, both the black and white version, and be able to understand the transition, the metamorphosis from the black to white swan. It's scary, scary process.
It is.
And once you understand that about yourself, there's really nothing more frightening that you could do in the rest of your life.
If I was that guy from, what is that show, Inside the Actor Studio? Is that analogous to your transition as a fighter?
I really, really try to, you know, personify
the Are you depth. The black swan or the white swan when you fight?
It's the journey to the black swan. I'm neither. You know, it's like the scary down the rabbit hole. You know, like I took the blue pill and now I'm becoming the black swan, and there's violent, scary things on the way there. And that's where I try to fight at, is on the journey to the black swan.
Is that why you come out to the rooster?
No, I come out to the rooster because it's a badass song.
It is a badass song.
And
roosters like to fight.
They do like to fight. But the song's about Vietnam. It's about Vietnam vets, the 101st. They used to call the tail gunners or the machine gunners the rooster on the team.
Is that Alice in Chains?
Yeah. So like POWs, MIA, Vietnam vets, all of them, that song, the song was written by lead singer about his father who disenchanted, they grew apart, and he kind of resented him for being in the war. And then he kind of had this revelation that it was like he had to, he didn't have a choice, he's drafted. So he wrote that song to connect, reconnect with his father, who is a Vietnam vet. So that song has a lot of meaning to me and my community, you know, veterans. So when I walk out of that song, man, I feel like there's nothing you could hit me with a freight train and I wouldn't care. You know, I got grabbed portions of my body and try to keep fighting.
It's a great fucking song for you, man. Mm-hmm. There's certain songs that just sort of, you hear that song and you know that guy's fighting. Like there's Country Boy Can't Survive when Matt Hughes mm-hmm. fights. You know, there's just no getting around it. Stranglehold, when Joseph Benavidez fights, he comes out to Ted Nugent Stranglehold, which is a great fucking song for him. You know, it's just there's certain songs that just personify a fighter.
Yeah.
You know, that's a good one for you, man.
Yeah, I'll have it forever. That's my song.
Do they give you any pressure about songs? Do they, like, you have to approve it? Because I know Uriah Faber always comes out to California Love,
mm-hmm.
but he wanted to do Going Back to Cali, and they wouldn't let him do it.
I don't think it's like the UFC, Zuffa. Yeah. I'm not sure it's them that, because they have to get rights to use that music in the production,
mm-hmm.
and I have no idea how legally that occurs. So sometimes they have a list of what you're allowed to do. You know, there are some fight promotions where, like, all right, you know, submit your song that you want to walk out to 2 weeks before, and we'll see if it's approved or if we can get approval. It's I don't know. I have no idea how it works, but thank God I can walk out to Rooster, because I'd be really sad if I couldn't.
Yeah, it's perfect for you. I'm glad that you have an exit strategy, because there are a lot of fighters that don't. And the saddest thing to me is a guy who looks at fighting as everything. Like, that is all they're capable of. That is all they're ever going to be. They don't know what to do next, and they get out of it, and they have this thing where they're diminished. Like, you could see their aura is diminished.
Yeah.
You know, if you believe in auras. But whoever they are, like, seems less when you're around them than who they were when they were competing.
Yeah, there's nothing more tragic than seeing the guy that bled and sweat for your entertainment, and at the end of his career, you know, he wasn't smart, or he didn't do things, you know, how he should have, and then at the end of his career, he has nothing. You know, he's fought 20 fights, he's broken physically and mentally, you know, and there's nothing left in him, and he has no resources to continue his life. You know, like, I have Ranger Up, you know, a company that I'm intimately part of. You know, I have great relationships with partners that are going to go outside of the cage when I'm done fighting, that are going to be part of whatever TV's, you know, series that I'm in. But it breaks my heart seeing these guys that, you know, at the end of their careers, they have nothing. And you're just like, God.
Yeah. Yeah. It breaks my heart too. And I've seen it so many times that it drives me fucking nuts, man. It drives me nuts. I almost want to, like, grab them in the middle when they're peaking and go, listen, man, this is beautiful, but it ain't going to last.
Yeah.
You got to have something else. You got to have something that you have as much passion for as you do this. Maybe that's one area where you have an advantage, and that you've been in so many life or death struggles, firefights, being deployed overseas, seeing life and death, and your perspective is far broader than a person who's just been an athlete. Just been an athlete that has just sought glory and believes that that is the end all be all.
Yeah. Maybe, you know, I definitely have this perspective that, you know, we have a shelf life as an athlete, and it's short. It's this window of opportunity that if you don't capitalize on it, you know, it's come and it's gone. And, most people don't understand that. You know, we have this window to earn. Our earning potential is small for an athlete. You know, like, I never had that. This is something that I wanted to do. I wanted to be champion. I want to be champion. And that's what I'm trying to achieve in this window. Not financial gain or like it, and if I don't achieve it in that window, I can move on, you know, to the next thing, to then achieve the next thing that I'm trying to do. But these guys that go in there, the Mike Tyson's a perfect example of where, you know, he literally pissed it all away. And then at the end of, you know, what happened to $230 million that you had?
Yeah.
You're bankrupt. So crazy.
Didn't you just stash away 10? Yeah. You could live off 10 for a long fucking time, man. Just take 10, blow 220. Yeah. It is crazy when you see those stories, but it's almost like the hubris that allows you to be a combat athlete in a lot of ways. This idea that I'm different, or like your idea that you're going to fucking parachute into sharks. You're going to be fine. I'll be fine. You know, I'm not like that poor fuck that was triathlon training off the course of coast of San Diego and got bitten in half in front of his friends. That happens, bro. It happens to anybody. Gets in there. It's a bad world. The ocean's a bad world.
It's a scary place.
I don't like it at all.
Sharks are beautiful.
Yeah, they're beautiful when you have them filleted over a grill. It's delicious as well. 170. This is the last question. Do you think that your best chance for a title would be at 170?
No, I think I'm close either. You know, like next fight, you know, who Joe Silva gives me is, you know, if it's the Vitor Belfort's Jacare's, you know, that puts me right there. You know, I'm number six. I beat number 2-3 guy. That's the title fight. You know, I'm 4-0 in the I'll be 4-0 in the UFC just beating in a title eliminator. My last two fights have been 5-rounder main events. You know, how can you not say, so am I, I'm potentially one fight away. You know, Mark Munoz and Musasi are fighting. Could I potentially be fighting the winner of that fight? You know, that's definitely in the realm too. And if that's the case, then maybe I am two fights away. If I cut down to 170, I don't think they'd let me fight for the title. You know, like I'd still be one fight away, maybe two. So no, I don't think I'd be any closer. Would physically, the physicality of like me being a bigger 170 than a lot of guys, stronger than 170, yes, there'd be benefits there. But again, diminished returns. Like, what am I giving up for that in exchange for?
Do you look at the window that you have? I mean, we've established that you think you have a 5-year window. Hmm. I know you don't want to give up the number, but you already did. Do you look at that and say, well, if I do get to a title shot at 185, how much time would I have left to work myself up to a title shot at 170? Or would I regroup and try it again at 185 if I wasn't successful the first attempt? Like, do you have those thoughts in your head, or do you just think about next fight?
No, I definitely have those thoughts in my head. I love having the 5-meter target. That's the super close thing that I'm looking at, that I'm like, this is the goal that I'm trying to achieve. I'm trying to get a perfect grouping right here. You know, that's that potential next opponent. You know, that's that guy that's ranked 2, 3, 4, so I can get a title eliminator type fight. But then I see the long road where, like, okay, I fight in that fight, I win, I'm fighting for the title, and I lose the title. Can I kind of Chael Sonnen it and talk my way into another title fight at a different weight class? You know,
Chael Sonnen it is an interesting way to describe it, because that's what a lot of people are doing now.
Yeah, dude. Right? When your name has become a verb, you know, like, dude, he just totally got Chael Sonnen.
Well, Chael's a master wordsmith. He really amazing. Is. You did a great fucking job Chael Sonnening it with this Michael Bisping fight, though. The both of you did. I mean, it got interesting, and I was very happy that you guys sort of sorted it out inside the octagon, and you both gave each other a lot of respect, but God damn, there was a lot going back and forth between you two.
Yeah, we're never going to be friends, you know. But when I hit him so hard, so like I had the same performance that in strikes landed in percentage that John Jones to Teixeira did as I did to Michael Bisping. Like, that's, I hit that guy that many times.
You blasted him with some hard shots. He took them.
He took them. You know, like, I know I hit hard. I put guys down in the gym with way less, and I'm wearing 4-ounce gloves, and Michael Bisping was like, hey, I'm here for 25 minutes. You're not going to put me away. Like, how can you not respect a guy for that?
Now, he's definitely a tough dude. He's very, very determined. He's also, like, you got to, like, give it up for him for mental toughness. Just not even considering retiring, the fact that he's fucked his eye up, had two eye surgeries, not even, it's just a thing I'm going to pull aside, get back in the gym, you know, work on my striking, you know. He's tough as they come. He's a born fighter. I mean, but that's what he's supposed to be doing.
Is he the personification of our nightmare of, you know, in 2-3 fights, let's say he loses 2 more fights, that is the end of his career. You know, his eye is going to be permanently damaged the rest of his life. You know, like, how much brain damage has he had, and how many fights and how many sparring preparations for a fight has he had? You know, and now he's done, and he's out of the limelight, and he's broken. You know, like, was he smart enough to prepare for that. I think he was, but you know, he is that example of, you know, like he left everything in the cage mm-hmm. time and time again. At 24 minutes of the fifth round, that dude was still trying to get up for me. You know, mm-hmm. like when the 32nd call was from our corners, he's like started coming right at me after I just dominated him for 24 and a half minutes.
Yeah, he wasn't giving up.
No.
He was still trying to win that fight.
Dude, what a great
He's athlete. A tough dude, yep. no doubt about it. And he's got some serious problems. He's got a real injury to his neck mm. that's affecting his strength of his arm. You know, he's as tough as they come, you know. He's definitely as tough as they come. But I know what you're saying as far as guys that accumulate injuries and then they get to a certain point in time and, like, what is left, you know.
Yeah.
There's a lot of guys that have done less, far, far less – you know, less successful than him, that their bodies have given out along the way.
Yeah.
It's a fucking hurt game. It's the hurt game, and the hurt game is along the way. Just the amount of accumulation of damage that you get in training. Forget yeah. about, that's what most casual fans just have no idea.
You see little cuts, a little bit of blood, a little bit of sweat in the fight. That's nothing. You know, like leading up to my 25-minute fight with Michael Bisping, like my sparring partners were like, Bob McDaniel and Carlos Condit when they're peaking for their fights, and then they moved on, and then, you know, I had John Jones, myself, like this room full of dudes that are the best in the world, and we're sparring two times a week for six, seven, 8 weeks, you know, like leading up to that fight, you know, and like we're hitting each other just as hard there as we are in the cage, you know, because you have to push yourself as far as you can in training so that the best element of who you and what you are occurs in the cage.
How do you feel about that? Like, as far as like sparring hard, do you think that you have to spar as hard as you fight? Or do you think that there's a way, like Robbie Lawler famously said that he doesn't really spar
much anymore.
He said he knows how to fight. He said it's just about getting in shape and working on his technique.
Yep. I spar way less than I used to, you know, like I, and on very rare occasions do I really go all out. But I think there are times in a fight camp where both your coaches need to see you and you need to see yourself when you're trying to do it all. You know, when you're broken, when you're hurt, when you're tired, you know, and sometimes the only way to get there is to push yourself to the limit. And the only way to get there is, man, by going after it.
And so you have to feel what it's like to be inside that position, to be inside that position where you're just duking it out at 100%. There's no holding back. You know what it's like to be exhausted. You know what it's like to be stung. You know what it's like to be hurt. You know what it's like to bounce back from being dominated in a training session. Like, there's no substitution for that actual fight.
No. You know, in grappling, like, am I in a position for, you know, a guy for me to work on an escape of an armbar? You know, there's, the 1,000 ways that I could have prevented ever getting there, but I still have to see what it's like to get out of it. And the only way I'll ever see what it's like to get out of it is if I'm actually put in it. So it's the same in fighting. Like, when I thought I had really hurt my hand in the first round, you know, I sit down, you know, and I come out the second round, I just tanked, you know, like pain, adrenaline dumps against Mike. You know, I come back to the corner at the end of the second round and they're like, all right, so you're going to lose this fight if you do that. I was at the pits, you know, like my hands hurt. I wasn't sure if I could throw my right hand again.
But you threw it.
Yeah.
What was wrong with it?
Broken.
It was broken.
Yeah.
But it's okay now.
Well, I have the brace in the car that I'm supposed to be wearing. I'm just embarrassed.
What's broken on it?
The metacarpal on this right here.
How bad is it broken? Is it
not
all the way
super
snapped
bad.
Through? Just
no.
a hairline
yep,
fracture?
Yeah, hairline fracture. They said 6 weeks in a cast, and I was like, I can't handle a cast. So they gave me a brace.
Just jump in the fucking ocean and have the sharks take care of it.
Yeah.
Dude, you're a crazy man. But that's why you do what you do.
Yeah.
Look, we're out of time. Tim Kennedy, you're a bad motherfucker.
This is
a very fun podcast.
Long time coming.
We got to do it again. And please, do one of your own, man. Please. You'd be awesome at it.
We'll see.
Please. Thank you. Follow Tim online. You can get a hold of him on Twitter, but be nice, you fuckheads. Don't be a dickwad, all right? Tim Kennedy MMA on Twitter. Do you have a website?
Yeah, Tim Kennedy MMA. Facebook's Tim Kennedy MMA. Everything's Instagram's Tim Kennedy MMA. It's Tim Kennedy MMA.
Tim Kennedy MMA, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much, brother. Yeah, it was a great time. Thanks to our sponsors. Thanks to 1-800-Flowers.com. Go to 1-800-Flowers.com and enter the code word JRE or call 1-800-Flowers and mention JRE to get yourself 24 beautiful multicolored roses for just $29.99. And that is regularly $49.99, so you will save yourself $20. That offer is only good today. It expires tomorrow, which is Thursday, May 8th. So do that, you fucks. And thank you, 1-800-Flowers. Thank you also to Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com. Stamps.com and use the code word JRE to get a $110 bonus offer, which includes a free digital scale and up to $55 of free postage. Save yourself the inconvenience of the post office. Print U.S. postage directly from your home computer, folks. Thanks also to Onnit.com. Go to O-N-N-I-T, use the code word Rogan, and save 10% off any and all supplements. All right, we will be back this weekend. Most likely, Brendan Shaw, Brian Cowan, and I are going to do a podcast simultaneously while the UFC is on Saturday night. And I think I have a podcast with Aubrey this weekend, too. A lot of good shit coming up. A lot of good people. Much love to everybody. Big kiss.